Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
You okay?
What happened? The hell she say?
I don't know.
Just get us some water. Get help.
What are you doing? Get moving.
Dude, Nikki's dead.
Where the hell's Nikki?
Is over, but we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Post Show Recaps. Razzle Dazzle, Season 3, Episode 14, Exposé. It's time to bury Nikki and Paolo alive. Josh Wigler, I'm joined here by Mike Bloom, also known as the Cobra, secretly. Did I spoil that?
Damn it! Why did you out me, Josh? Now I'm going to have to kill you.
I was supposed to save that for a dramatic reveal, right? Instead of just like kind of matter-of-factly stating
don't
that you've been the Cobra
the entire time.
Don't
worry about it, baby. It's okay. Let me just shrug off the jacket draped casually over my shoulders and I hide this briefcase of money.
Mike, so with Stranger in a Strange Land, we're talking about the episode that's the most popularly known as like the worst episode of Lost, right? I think here with Exposé, we've reached the most controversial episode of Lost short of the finale.
Yeah, well, actually, I would say we're across the sea, right?
But yeah, across the sea isn't super divisive, though. You know, I think, like, across the sea, like, most people are on the line of, like,
That's exactly what I was about to say, because I know that we're going to get to it, actually. There was an interview with Damon and Carlton before the finale where they said they were talking, sort of ruminating over the history of Lost, much like we'll sort of ruminate over the history of Lost so far in this episode. And they were saying, you know, oh, there were polarizing episodes, like, across the sea, or maybe to a lesser extent, Exposé, but I would, to your point, flip it and reverse it, Missy Elliott style. I think that Across the Sea definitely comes down on the negative much more than the positive, whereas I do think that Exposé probably has the most divided opinion across the Lost fandom, which will, spoiler alert, reflect in
the
rankings, in the ratings from our own listeners here. I think you and I are kind of on the same page, maybe to varying degrees.
But I expect that we actually are on pretty close to the same page, even
right,
if
our rankings
are a little different. I think that
our opinion is the same. It just matters as to like how we rate a Lost episode.
Exactly.
That'll be the big difference.
100%. Yeah. So I think like for me, like maybe divisive is the word, because like Exposé feels like it's an episode you love or you hate. And like I think if you hate Exposé, I have yet to hear like the really compelling reason as to why you hate Exposé, at least without taking into account the full picture of Exposé, without taking into account that like you only hate Exposé because you hate Nikki and Paolo and everything that they stand for. Well, you're not alone. Like, I feel like the creators of Lost are also like, yeah, we screwed that up. That wasn't good. We got to bury them alive. And I think like the gripe seems to be like, you should have just like pretended like they never existed, just like
we acknowledge the fact that it's a mea culpa. I think we can also talk about the timing of it all. We spoke about this a lot when it comes to episodes, particularly in this post Hydra arc, of like Stranger in a Strange Land, Trisha Tanaka. I feel like expose is sort of part of that discussion as to when you're putting together the puzzle pieces of this latter two thirds of season three of Lost, why here? Why now? And we can certainly talk about that, but we talked about this last week, how just monumental of an episode The Man from Tallahassee was. So much happened in both the mythos of John Locke, blowing up the sub.
Right.
You know, we finally have a lot of the 815ers come together with the others here, and then we leave that behind completely for an episode as we deal with all this other shenanigans going on the other part of the island, which we sort of have been doing on and off. You know, we again look at Stranger in a Strange Land versus Trisha Tanaka is Dead as a good example. And I could imagine that part of it as well came down to like, why was this episode at this part here? Which again, flashback to when we talked about Trisha Tanaka is Dead. That was a very big complaint at that time too, of why are we suddenly doing this sort of like, quote, fluff episode amidst all this other intense stuff going on?
Yeah. So we had had this question from Daniel Brennan, who said, I didn't start watching Lost Live until the end of season three. So I'm always curious about the fan experience from the time before I was on board. Did fans know that Exposé was going to be a Nikki and Paolo episode? Were people excited? Were they confused? And my experience and my memory of this is, yeah, like, because like typically if you were like an extremely online Lost fan, you would know episode titles and you had the ability at least to know who the centricity was. And right. So it was known that the Nikki and Paolo episode was coming up. And I think there was a lot of groaning involved. I think there was a lot of like, oh, really, these guys? But not to mention,
it was on paper continuing a trend, right, of like, again, we've gotten some really stellar flashback episodes, but I would say probably at least two thirds of them were meh, verging on not very good. You know, when you have a season that's filled with Locke, you know, being on a pot farm,
right,
and Kate marrying Nathan Fillion and Sawyer, right, going to jail and Jack going to Thailand, it's like, oh, great, just add another one onto the pile of here's Nikki and Apollo, two characters we really don't care about, and we find out their backstory.
Right, right. But I think that the thing that no one knew, at least I didn't know, was that the episode was going to be their death episode. Not only that it was going to be their death episode, but it was effectively their death episode from the very from the very beginning. That the very first scene, essentially, like in the first, you know, pre-credits act, is going to involve Nikki, quote-unquote, dying. And that the first time that you would see Paolo in the context of the modern day would be his dead body in the jungle. So all of that was really,
yeah,
really
surprising. It's weird to think about the fact that Nikki and Paolo technically do not speak, I will say, cogently in the present timeline. All of their dialogue is seen in the past. And this structure is also not unfounded, right? This is sort of a spiritual sequel to the other 48 days, which is essentially a, hey, let's take a look at what was going on while 815 is sort of brilliant, valiantly fighting the fight.
I think it's almost
the first
more,
seasons.
Though, like a prologue for The Brig. Like, I think that The Brig is an episode where the flashbacks take place on the island, but there is a main island story. And in Exposé, the flashbacks take place in the past, but there is a main island story, and there is a main Nikki and Paolo story, Mike. It's just that they cannot move, and they cannot express to anybody that they are still alive. So
then
let me
amend that and say
there.
I'll say then it's a sequel to Maternity Leave from that perspective,
yeah,
right?
I think that that's correct.
On island flashbacks with the main island story based around the same character.
Yeah. Sans hammer banging.
Oh my God. Though I think some people would rather hear, a straight episode of hammer banging and screaming than seeing Nikki and Paolo again, if you look at these ratings.
Yeah, but Damon and Carlton both agree that Exposé is the most polarizing episode. In an interview with Mike Ryan, they said that the one that was the most polarizing was Exposé, the Nikki and Paolo episode, which we loved. And in that case, there were definitely fans, particularly ones who treated the show really reverentially, that couldn't stand it and they hated it. So there was a little bit of a sense of a division on that episode because we totally dug it and we loved it. That's the episode I think is probably the most polarizing. And I completely agree. I think that this is Exposé is like a stress test for where you're ultimately at with Lost. Do you take it uber seriously? Is it about the mythology? Is it about the story even less so than the mythology, like the character storyline? Or is it a show that... So I was watching Exposé in the Post Show Recaps patron Discord this past week. And I did it as one of the weekly Wednesday night watch parties that we do in there. If you didn't know that we do weekly Wednesday night watch parties in the Post Show Recaps patron Discord, there's another reason to potentially sign up.
Patreon.com. Add it onto the list.
Patreon.com/Post Show recaps every Wednesday night, just about. I think it's going to be Tuesday night next week. Just
I will say, I think reasons to join the Discord are worth their weight in diamonds. Yeah. Even though these diamonds do not weigh very much, apparently.
We got to talk about that. And so while I was in there, I said something that I actually said on the Mandalorian podcast that I do with Kevin and LaTanya earlier in the week, which is that, like, the Mandalorian is secretly, when it's at its best, it's like, it's the Mando and Baby Yoda hangout show, right? Like, mm-hmm, it's a hangout show where, like, you're every week, like, you're just, like, on a different mission with those guys and just, like, having a fun time. And I think that oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes Lost does these hangout episodes. It's why I love Trisha Tanaka so much. It's the best hangout episode for me. Exposé is kind of more in line with the hangout episode stuff. There's some mythology stuff. We're going back and we're going back and we're revisiting season one. We're going back and we're seeing different sides of things. So there's like mythology there, but it's ultimately more hangouty in like the story of the 815ers on the beach and how they're interacting and sort of the you know, it's like kind of like this Tales from the Crypt, like creep show type of Lost episode. And so it's like something that's doing something more genre heavy in a way.
I've always subtitled this episode CSI Lost because this really is something that we don't ever really get on Lost again, which is this was a completely self-packaged, like, murder mystery.
It's great.
Almost. Yeah. Where, unfortunately, our ragtag crew of forensic scientists do not solve the puzzle. We end up doing so because we have the information, but it's something distinctly different. But to your point, I mean, I think it does bear a lot of comparisons to Trisha Tanaka is Dead in terms of, again, it's this sort of based on 815. It's not necessarily, you know, I would push back against the idea that it's really mythology based. We really don't get too much like new information outside of the fact that we get the confirmation that Ben and Juliet were indeed like grooming Jack, or at least really watching him to pick where he would be. And obviously we know now that Paolo was not pooping in the Pearl Station. In fact, I don't think anyone will be because the damn toilet tank is full of Russian dolls.
Yeah.
So creepy. But I guess my question to you is, because again, let's talk about timing here. Is Exposé impacted not even by the fact that it comes after the man from Tallahassee, but the fact that it comes so soon after Trisha Tanaka, which to your point has a similar sort of, maybe not tone, but maybe almost a similar sort of purpose and structure to it.
Maybe in the weekly, but I don't think so in maybe on the first watch is what I would say, but I don't think so much on the second watch. I really don't. I think that I feel like we are closing the book on book one of Lost with season three. This is what I've been saying for a very long time, that I really view this show as a two-part show. Act one is almost over and we're getting into act two pretty soon. Once we're through the looking glass. And so this is not the last moment that we're going to get something that has like significant hangout elements on Lost, like an episode that's more whimsical than it's not. Even if the whimsy is pretty bleak with what Hurley
does. It's blimsy.
You know, but like I think that I don't think that that's an impactor for me, at least. But I can't speak for everybody. There may be a subset of people that feel that way. For me, I feel like when you consider that we are rushing towards the end of that first part, we're like surviving the day to day, unlocking the immediate mysteries. Those are the priorities. The getting to know you stuff is still a priority here. Like solidifying a little bit more of like, who are you in relation to these other characters that you're stranded with? Like those are sort of like the primary focuses here. And then the second act, starting with season four, we're on the other side of the hill and we're, you know, snowballing downstream. I don't know if you snowball downstream.
I was going to say, those are mixed metaphors.
We're on a mountain covered in snow, and the snowball is accumulating snow, and then it's just going to dissipate in a stream, according to some
easy
people's
come, easy go
interpretation of the ending, a.k.a. they didn't like it. So I think that for me, I am very, for not just forgiving, but perhaps even unapologetic about my love for this type of stuff on Lost, because I think that if the story of Lost ultimately does land for you, if it evades the dissolution in the stream and instead plows through a village and leaves major impact.
Oh, that's a dangerous snowball.
Then I think it's because of episodes like Trisha Tanaka, like Exposé, that enrich the characters, that imbue you with a sense of fun. But it doesn't land for everybody, and I get that. I just have not yet seen like the supremely compelling reason to outright bash this episode. And to put a finer point on it, without identifying the person, somebody like submitted a zero in the ratings for.
Don't worry, it was not Ben Martell.
It was not Ben Martell, but somebody submitted a zero for Exposé. And I believe in the rationale, and I may be conflating this with a different person who gave it a low score, basically saying, like, this is the I don't watch this episode. I skipped this episode. Well, if you're never going to let yourself reevaluate it with the distance, you know, with the benefit of time and distance, then, you know, you're not giving it a chance. And I would say,
if Josh could put up the stones to rewatch Fire Plus Water, an episode he usually skips in his rewatches, you could do the same with Exposé.
All right, so let's go forth into the jungle. Exposé, directed by Stephen Williams, written by Kitsis and Horowitz. I think maybe their best episode of the show, personally, but
a bit of a low bar to clear.
No, they have some good ones in there.
They have some good ones.
We've done this before. We don't need.
We've
to go
done this before, anything. But I will say some good ones.
March 28, 2007, and Mike. Normally, this is where I take us forth into the jungle. I usually have like a copious section of notes to read from, but unfortunately, my notes were paralyzed before we got on to record this podcast. So I believe you have your own notes of the episode, so you will be the one who guides us through this week.
And this seems pertinent, right? When it comes to changing POV, this is not the first time that we've done that. But like, let's change up the formula a bit, and hopefully this has not become the last time that I'm able to you know, maybe give up the notes. Unfortunately, it seems like Nikki and Paolo are sort of done for. I think Nikki does make one more non-speaking appearance in the series, but I'm pretty sure this is a series wrap on Rodrigo Santoro after this episode.
Is there like an expose scene in the background or something?
It might be that, because I know, I can't remember, like, have we seen David Reyes watch Exposé yet? Or maybe I'm thinking of another episode.
Not to my memory.
So I think when we get to off-island stuff, I think that maybe that's when they're talking about Nikki technically appearing on the screen again.
Got it, okay.
So let's go forth into the jungle here with a brand new voice. There is no previously on, because spoiler alert, this entire episode is essentially a previously on. And so even though this is something that we have seen in several episodes up to this point, it's a big clue, not misclue, as to how this episode's going to be just a little bit different. And we sort of started in media res here, right? Nikki is frantically running through the jungle. She is digging through the dirt and burying something. It'll take a long time, both in the past and the present, for us to find out what that thing is. But very quickly, we get a flashback to Nikki seemingly being some sort of exotic dancer. Mm-hmm. Under the name Corvette, she has taken to the pole. We hear the dulcet sounds of Wreckx-n-Effect. It's spelled Wreckx-n-Effect. So I don't know how to pronounce it.
Wreckx.
Wreckx-n-Effect.
Wreckx.
Like a Wreckx. But she is, you know, she's doing her thing. You know, Josh, we're going to get into this, but in doing some research from this episode, I did find out that there was a previous draft of this episode that was supposed to be an entire episode of only flashbacks for Nikki, only to reveal at the very end of the episode that those flashbacks were just scenes from the TV show Exposé.
That would have been something.
It would have been, no, I mean, I'll typify it. It would have been bad. It would have been a very bad rug pull on behalf of Lost. I think that would have been, again, for all the grousing people made about flashbacks this season, at least those were real in people's lives. I think a lot of people would have been like, you have wasted my time with an hour of watching a TV show within a TV show. So luckily, they do that rug pull right at the beginning here, and it comes in a very fantastic fashion as Corvette is going to break into the back room where her boss, Mr. Lestat, is receiving a hefty payout from some seedy individuals. And let's hear some of this incredible dialogue for what will ultimately be Nikki Fernandez's final scene in the hit show Exposé.
No, that's the money for the orphanage. That means, Mr. Lestat, you're the Cobra.
Sorry, baby, it's just business.
All this time it was you.
Pretty and smart. What a shame.
Razzle dazzle!
Crystal, bad news. Corvette was working for the Cobra. But fear not. He will pay.
Okay, I'll cut the clip there. I'll follow your direction.
But they tell you to do that. Incredible. Billy D. Williams says, I believe you said Mr. Lestat, and then I envisioned Mr. Lestat.
oh, interview with the vampire. Yeah. I could imagine Billy D. Williams would be very interesting in that role.
I think he'd be very good in that role. But Billy D. Williams playing Billy D. Williams, playing Mr. Rashad, who is secretly the Cobra. Like, already the ways in which this episode is trying to let you know, like, We're in on it. This whole thing is going to be a lark, and we know it, and we're in on it. This is, it's meta. We're doing Community before Community did Community. Like, that's what's going on here.
We haven't gotten the Lost movie yet either.
No, not yet. Inevitable.
Yeah, but I think there's so much fun stuff to talk about this scene, because they really, Kitsis and Horowitz lean so much into the schlock of it all. You know, we're going to find out more about Howard Zuckerman's work later on. We do not see the other works that he does, but like, if this is any indication, this is just so much great fat to chew on. We got to hear the outright razzle dazzle of it all, in which Nikki delivers, albeit like very poorly, but I think that's done on purpose. Just the great line of like, that money's for the orphanage.
That money's for the orphanage.
I believe we heard that when we've heard it on the TV before, but like to actually see it now conceptualized is so great. Billy D. Williams sounding like even more like he's on Quaaludes than what we're used to hearing from him is just so great, because it's sort of informed that like he's phoning this in to the nth degree. And the most interesting part about it is that, to your point, this is, I think, the only time that a celebrity appears as themselves, Entourage style, on Lost. We've gotten, you know, mentions to like Christopher Reeve and George Bush before. There have been name checks, but no one was like, okay, Billy D. Williams, you will come on as Billy D. Williams.
Right, playing Mr. Rashad. Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing that I found out about Razzle Dazzle that is really interesting. So Razzle Dazzle is a reference to, I don't know if, Josh, you grew up in the tri-state area, as did I. Do you remember the Ron and Fez show?
No, you'll have to remind me, although it sounds familiar.
Yeah, so Ron and Fez show was sort of like one of those Howard Stern sort of knockoff shock jock shows, like Opie and Anthony on XM satellite radio. Basically, from Lostpedia, it says, associate producer Eastside Dave starts off a weekly gossip segment with the voiceover of another producer saying razzle dazzle in a ridiculous fashion. Brian K. Vaughn, new writer on Lost and a big Ron and Fez fan, said recently during a visit in studio that he would be working some references to their show into the dialogue of Lost. And so a lot of people speculated that, like, this was Brian K. Vaughn sneaking in a reference. You know, it'd be like if you were a big fan of Comedy Bang Bang and you snuck, like, a Hey Nong Man reference into a show that you were writing. Apparently,
or, like, if I were a big fan of Lost and I snuck a lot of Lost references into the book that I'm working on right now.
You would never.
No chance.
And also another fun fact, I don't know if you paid attention to the slate board that the AD that we previously heard called cut on, but do you know whose name was on that slate?
No.
Stephen Williams.
Hey, all right. So, Stephen
so the
Williams.
Director of this episode of Exposé. So maybe Billy D. Williams is the first, but I guess Stephen Williams is technically the second real person to appear as themselves on Lost.
That's great. And very funny, because like Exposé is totally like a show that Stephen Williams would have directed at that point in his career.
Absolutely.
So really, 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 really super fun. Everything about this is great. I believe like it's a series wrap on Nikki Fernandez, right? And like we're getting out of there.
And so there's some really interesting stuff here, because we sort of get some nice expo dumps, and there'll be a lot of dumps going on and on the Paolo variety in this episode. We found out that Nikki is an actress. She is a guest star on Exposé, and now she has gotten killed off. You know, she gets comforted by the series creator that we'll find out is Howard Zuckerman. Some really great meta stuff here again, once you know how this episode ends, where I believe Nikki says outright, like, I'm just a guest star. You know what happens to them, considering what's going to happen
Maybe
to her
we'll
character.
Maybe we'll bring you back next season with a bulletproof vest. Or a bulletproof breast.
Exactly.
Hey, hey,
and
hey.
So he takes them, a Yogi Bear, apparently, according to Josh, takes them outside, and it appears they're filming in Australia, because say with me, everybody, they're right next to the Sydney Harbour, where apparently everything is.
That's the Opera House, right? So you know they're in Australia. How else would you be able to recognize us.
I just love that within this, like, I'm assuming within the same plaza is the studio where they filmed this, where Boone is staying with Shannon, you know, where the hotel where Walt and Michael were staying prior to taking off an Ocean to Game
5. I don't know what the problem is. It's, they're all supposed to be here. It's their destiny. They got summoned to this point in their lives. So yeah, it makes sense that they're all here at this moment in time. No,
I also gotta say Howard Zuckerman looks like a real George Carlin type. Maybe it's just kinda, like the pulled back gray hair.
I think of like a Wes Craven or a George Romero, just like or even a George Lucas.
No,
not quite a George Lucas. Shout out to Billy D. Williams, by the way, who we talked about on the Star Wars Survivor Brant Steele on Rob Has a Podcast. No spoilers about how that one turned out, other than to say. Mike and I agree that, narratively speaking, one of our favorite Brant Steele simulations we've ever done.
Definitely one of the most satisfying. The snowball has promptly dissipated in the stream, to use your metaphor from before. But it turns out that, you know, that this whatever type you want to compare Zuckerman to, no matter what, he is romancing the stone, or at least Nikki was romancing to get some stones later on, as they have a passionate kiss in front of the Sydney Harbor. It does bring up the question, like, you know, which came first, Nikki being brought onto the show or her starting a relationship with Zuckerman. We don't get much background as to what the onus of their relationship is. Josh, have you ever done any sort of, like, headcanon as to how this all happened?
No. Not a ton.
Yeah, it's interesting, because, I mean, we're going to find out a lot about Nikki. One of the things that I find really interesting about this episode, that spoiler alert is going to make a reflection in my personal LVP points, is Nikki at this point has been fairly innocuous, really, outside of that one deleted scene that we talked about in Further Instructions where she's caught having sex in Jack's tent. Like, Paolo, at least on island, has been the more negative Nancy. But this episode proves that Nikki, in my opinion, is as bad, if not outright worse, than Paolo is in terms of being a person.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the island events bear out that, like, if Paolo is maybe more, like, in love with Nikki, I think Nikki more, like, is just, like, sort of, like, tolerant of Paolo as, like, a means to get to the diamonds. Like, she seems to be more in love with the diamonds than she is with Paolo, at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. She's more in love with, like, she's sort of like Sawyer in that variety, right? Of like, eh, I won't let my heart get into it. I'm after one goal at the end of the day, and that's myself.
Yes.
Every man for himself.
Yes, yes. So that's when we come back to the moment that we heard at the top of the podcast, right?
Right, and it's a fun continuation also from the Enter 7-7 plot, where it's, I would imagine that either Sawyer is now, like, playfully engaging in ping pong with Hurley, or, like, I could imagine Sawyer's trying to, con man style, trying to, like, learn from Hurley as to how to become a better player.
I was saying in the Discord during the watch party that if Hurley is the Jedi Master of ping pong, then Sawyer is his Padawan.
Oh, yes. Oh,
how about that?
My heart is soaring.
I'm so proud.
I'm so proud.
So just like the one single braid in Sawyer's hair coming down. Show me the way. This is the way.
Show me the way to go home.
Yeah. Tired and I want to play ping pong.
So we heard this in the intro. Nikki comes running out and she sort of mutters something to herself. Exactly. Before dying. And of course we have another fantastic meta line here. Dude, Nikki's dead. Who the hell's Nikki? It will not be the last time Sawyer asks that, but it's a great sort of button to begin the episode of. Yeah, who the hell is Nikki?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's just like, it's so ridiculous, right? It's just absolutely absurd. It's just like right up front before we smash to credits, a character is dead. This is a series regular, should not be a series regular. And Sawyer is commenting on that of like, wait, who? You know, it's very, very, very clear that that's what's going on. It's very funny.
This is a really interesting Sawyer episode. Like, he admittedly does some sketchy stuff, but I think especially when we look ahead to Sawyer the cop, this is a big sort of indicator as to, I don't know if they thought that's where this was going to go at this point in time, but where he's going to end up in another universe.
Yeah, pretty much. So, really just a great opening arc to this episode, from the Billy D. Williams stuff. So starting off propulsively with like Nikki running through the jungle, like you're already kind of like, okay, so what's going on here? Like, they effectively set up the mystery, I think, pretty well. Just like from like a noir perspective, like I think they do a good job of just like kind of framing you into that kind of story.
Yeah, actually, I think the strongest thing about this episode is the structure, is the way they sort of like both, you know, the best twists in pop culture, in my opinion, are ones that you don't see at all coming the first time you watch it. But then when you watch it back, there are so many clues being put in place that indicate where things are going to end up. And I feel like exposé is one of those pieces of pop culture that perfectly threads that needle.
Yeah, for sure.
So we come back and we get a flashback. Oddly enough, we sort of get the weird thing where they, other 48 Days style, but they actually use the correct font this time. You know, subtitle like, oh, this was a certain number of days ago, but we are still in Australia. It seems like Exposé was filming in Australia. Was Josh, is Australia like the Vancouver / Toronto for American productions in the mid 2000s?
I don't know. I mean, I think that no, Vancouver was still the Vancouver of the mid 2000s. but a lot of productions are moving to Australia. Australia has a very robust film scene. I don't know how much of a robust TV scene. I don't know if the Lord of the Rings show is shooting in New Zealand or Australia off the top of my head. I'm sure the man behind the curtain will be able to correct the record.
Well, if it's the former, then we'll really know.
But Marvel shoots a ton in Australia. Tons of movies shoot down there. Yeah. So really not a surprise that they're filming in Australia. It just, what is maybe a little bit of a surprise to me is like, it might be suggestive of like a bigger budget project, and Exposé does not appear to be a big budget project. So
exactly.
Unless it's like a big budget, like, you know, like everyone is in on the joke with Exposé. But it feels like in the universe of Lost, the tastemakers like Hugo Hurley Reyes are super in on Exposé.
Yeah, and that's the thing as well, is that, you know, if this was, you would imagine if this was a more cost-cutting procedure, they would go to, like, Atlanta, right? Or even, like, I feel like it's much easier to go across the border and film in Toronto than it is to fly an entire crew and cast multiple hours to Australia to film. So, I don't know, it seems like Howard Zuckerman is pretty loaded, so maybe he's able to do it on his own personal penny. So affluent, Josh, that he's able to have his own new personal chef, who, surprise, surprise, is Paulo.
Yeah, the Wolfgang Puck of Brazil.
Which Amazing Race fans may also prognosticate that maybe once upon a time, a Michelle Newland type would stop Paulo in an airport and grill him for hours on end about his cooking technique.
Was Wolfgang Puck on an episode of The Amazing Race?
Yeah, let me stop down for a second and say that there was a deleted scene in the first episode of The Amazing Race where they were flying out of L.A. One team recognized Wolfgang Puck,
who,
and not
you
only
don't know, he's a, like a very like in the restaurant industry is very famous.
Yeah, he really is like the Paulo of you know,
the
Paulo cooking
of the actual restaurant industry. Many steakhouses, has Spago in Los Angeles. I was mentioning on the live watch that he is famous for having a pizza that's covered in smoked salmon.
That sounds
controversial. I have not had it.
I'm surprised it's not covered in shaved truffle, considering that the Wolfgang Puck of Brazil in Paulo is apparently specializes in that.
Very heavy-handed with the truffle. Maybe that should have been the giveaway, that Paulo's not actually a chef.
Yeah, or that Zuckerman is affluent, right? As we talked about in during Top Chef, like, all those truffles cost so much money that, like, to use them like that is really saying something. Do you think it's Paulo or Howie's idea that he has to wear the chef's jacket while he's working?
I would assume that that's Paulo's, because my headcanon on this is that Paulo's undercover. And he's not actually a chef. Otherwise, I think we would have seen him in the scenes.
Wait,
with
so
chef
do you think he just like ordered in and just like disguised it as like steamed ham style?
Yes, 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 exactly, yes. And so like he's like, well, if I'm a chef, I have to wear the jacket. So he wears the jacket because he's a chef. He's supposed to do it.
You know what that reminds me now? Actually, maybe it's the accent. It reminds me so much of Agador Spartacus from The Birdcage.
Yeah.
Or let's just imagine Paulo like tripping in his shoes, like, I've got dreams for you, Mr. Zuckerman.
He's just in deep cover. That's it. That's it.
I also have to say, I don't know if you noticed this as well, Josh. For some reason, Rodrigo Santoro's accent comes out much more prominently in this episode than any of the previous ones. Maybe it's because Paulo has the most to speak in this episode, but I don't remember hearing it, really.
Filmmaker Howard Zuckerman is dad. is my favorite example.
Oh, that's the big twist. He killed his own dad.
Is dad. Yeah, dad?
Dad? So, I mean, apparently, whether Paulo prepared these or not, he has a bevy of things, not only including shaved truffles, apparently an entire bread basket filled with homemade rolls of all varieties. Maybe to your point, that's the first clue that this is not, Paulo's not the real McCoy here.
Yeah.
But among the many rolls, one is sort of covered by a nice little diamond bracelet that Howie is giving to Nikki. And before Howie just gives like a little bit of exposition that apparently Howie Zuckerman is actually doing a little bit of foul play on his current marriage in taking up with Nikki, those end up being his last words as he coils over and we finally get a true glimpse of, I think, what will be quote unquote the real Nikki in this episode, where she essentially just immediately does like a heel turn and is like, oh my God, I actually had to taste this dude's food and, you know, romance this oldie for so long.
Yeah. What took you so long, Paolo?
Yeah. And that's really going to be the tone that Nikki takes on for a lot of this, right? It's like her really shuffling off a lot of blame onto poor Paolo here.
Yeah. Yeah. Truffling a lot of blame onto poor Paolo here.
And so they immediately, before the body is even cold or the rolls are even cold, they go into a closet safe. We get a little glimpse here of, again, something that's to come, the smoking gun, if you will, emphasis on smoking. Paolo's going to try to take this moment to try to smoke a cigarette. And Nikki does wisely point out here, like, what the hell are you doing? We're trying to cover up our tracks here. You're going to leave ashes.
Well, I think
around.
In this continued battle of the two, who is like the Harry and who is the Marv?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I think like clearly Harry is Nikki, right? Like, she's the one who's always trying to talk sense into like, he's like, no, but we could be the smoking bandits. We could be the smoky bandits.
Yeah, we leave the ash around, yeah, and everyone knows it's the smoky.
Everything smells like cigarettes. It's like, no, you idiot. Put that away.
So Howie has...
Nikki, I've reached the top.
Just imagine now they open up the safe and like Howie gets hit in the head with a bowling ball, or Paolo gets in the head with like a gets in the crotch with a paint can.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great.
But there are no paint cans or shocking doorknobs or anything like that. Just a Russian nesting doll, which is also a fun metaphor, not only for this episode, but Lost in general, right? A mystery inside of a mystery inside of a mystery.
Yeah, and I think in this, a show within a show within a show, or like, yeah, like very much this idea of like, we hated it. The fans hated it. We made a show about how we and the fans hated it. You know? Like, and then we made a show that exists within that world in which we and the fans hate it. Like, I think that there's just a lot of layers to expose that you could break through.
So let's cut back to the present here. And we have our first little like McLaughlin group of the ramshackle CSI crew. This is going to be a big episode for Sawyer, for Hurley, for Charlie, and for Sun. I would say those are sort of like the big four who get a lot of focus during the present timeline. It appears that Sawyer and Hurley have now brought in Charlie and Sun in on what's exactly happening here. And there's going to be, a la Lost in Translation, which I believe was coming out around this time, actually, Josh, a lot of talk around what would be Nikki's final words. Let's hear the group sort of give their first pseudo-autopsy to what's going on right now. Sound number two.
What happened?
You don't know. She's got no gunshot wound, no knife wound, no polar bear bite, nothing.
Maybe it was something she ate.
Maybe she was poisoned.
We should check the food supply to see if anyone else is sick.
She's got gunk under her fingernails. Where'd you find her?
Right here. She stumbled out of the jungle, face planted, said something like plywood, and it's starting on.
Actually, I think she said power lines.
Well, who the hell knows what she said? She was 5 seconds from dying. Probably seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Paolo lies. That's what she said. Paolo lies, not power lines. Paolo lies.
Who the hell's Paolo?
Paolo's her husband or boyfriend or whatever. They live down the beach.
Well, where the hell is he? Because if he lies, that might be a good place to start.
Imagine if the big twist of the episode was indeed, Josh, that Nikki was saying plywood.
she was saying paddle wands.
She was saying power line because she was remembering when she and her dad took that cross country road trip and she really wanted to see power line in concert. And so she tricked her dad into diverting the road trip to go there.
I love this whole crew. I think this is great. And one of the things that I love about this episode, and there's other instances of it as we dig deeper, are these moments where they're talking about all of the different things that have happened on Lost, basically. Like, it could be the others. It could be the monster.
Yeah, I do love that, Charlie's like, she's poisoned, and Son's like, no one would ever do that.
Yeah, you know, so just like all of that is incredible.
Yeah, we're going to get a lot of callbacks to bad deeds that these characters have done. Surprisingly little remembrance of Sun poisoning Jin once upon a time. But yeah, so there's a lot of theories going around at this point, including what they said. Hurley jumps to the conclusion that Paolo left. I mean, it's going to lead them in the right direction, that they should be looking for Paolo. But that's also going to be the conventional wisdom that we are going to be under, considering how this is going to happen as we go to yet another flashback. We are in the airport. As you talked about, Paolo reads the obituary of his dad, Howie, who has not only created Exposé, but Strike Team Alpha and Dr. Kincaid Esquire.
Oh, Dr. Kincaid Esquire is dad. I believe is how he says it.
Maybe that means that Paolo's father played Dr. Kincaid on Dr. Kincaid Esquire.
Yeah, Dr. Kincaid Esquire is my dad.
Maybe that's how he knew about Howie and got so close to him. But you would imagine his dad would put in a good word for him, like, you got to hire my son. He's a fantastic chef.
Yeah, I wonder who his sister is in this narrative. If Dr. Kincaid Esquire is the Christian shepherd of this meta universe that's being created.
For some reason, I imagine Dr. Kincaid Esquire would have been played by like Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. That's all alternate universe Frasier.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
The Lost World, Frasier is Dr. Kincaid Esquire.
He didn't get the Cheers spinoff, but he was able to land the role on Dr. Yeah. Kincaid Esquire.
And so this is around the time that Boone and Shannon show up, right?
Yes, they do.
We're on deep wig watch here, folks.
Woof, yeah. Ian Somerhalder, it's just gotten worse and worse with the times Boone has appeared.
And I can't leave him alone on an island because Maggie Grace, that's not the Shannon hair we know.
No, it is much more voluminous.
It's definitely different. It's really fun, especially this is our first sighting of Shannon since she died. So it's nice to have Maggie Grace back on. I've missed her.
Nice in a couple of, and let's put that in rough quotations, because let's remember this is also beginning of season one.
Sure,
Shannon.
Sure, of course. But I'm just the early days of the Down the Hatch rewatch, I found myself feeling fonder about Shannon.
And this is also why I've always enjoyed this episode, is because for the most part, and we'll get to it, this is a fun sort of callback to a lot of Lost season one, which obviously has such a soft place in my heart, that to sort of like go back through everything like, oh yeah, I remember the crash. It's weird to speak fondly about a disastrous plane crash. But yeah, of course, Shannon and Boone, you know, I don't know if this is before or after she ends up doing a false call in on Saeed's bags, but she's being pretty awful to Boone about, like, grab the chair, don't grab the chair,
yeah, don't give him the stick,
and basically now accuses Boone of flirting with Paolo, yeah. Even though, again, they had just slept together the night before, so a lot of weird stuff in there. And of course, Nikki giving another fun prophetic line, promise me we won't end up like them. Technically, you will, just not in the variety. Boone and Shannon will be killed much further apart than these two will.
Yeah, and you also, and I think that this is another great meta moment of, like, promise me we won't end up like them. It's not just that we're not going to end up like annoying like they are in the context of like the universe of the show, but also to your point, Mike, that you made many weeks ago, this idea that like we're going to bring in background characters from 815 and show you that, yeah, the Sox, as they call them, we call them the Gawkers, Damon and Carlton mm-hmm. refer to them as the Sox, that there were actual like three-dimensional characters in there. And so like if that's the move that you're going to make, then you gotta give us something interesting here. Don't just give us Boone and Shannon 2.0. Boone and Shannon 1.0 didn't work out. You killed them. You killed them because they weren't working. And so this idea of Nikki saying to Powell, promise me we won't end up like them, well, they end up exactly like them mm-hmm. in terms of audience reception. So again, another way in which this episode is just like winking at everybody. Like it is an episode that is deeply aware of itself.
So we end up cutting to, of course, another great opportunity for Maggie Grace to scream as we re-litigate the events of the 815 crash. There is a Lost on Location featurette for this episode where they sort of talk about how they were able to reuse some footage from these episodes. We'll see this more particularly with the Live Together, Die Alone speech as an example, but they tried to reuse as much old footage as possible without making it look like, okay, we're just going to CGI Nikki and Paolo in there like a Star Wars updated edition character. So they actually brought in Maggie Grace and Ian Somerhalder to like film alternate shots. Yeah. And so the Shannon that we get screaming here to the point of the hair is season 3 Shannon, not season 1 Shannon, even though it's the exact same thing. But, you know, Nikki, we get a lot of this from Nikki's perspective. She unfortunately gets caught up in the poor Gary Troop of it all as we see him fly into the propeller one last time. Nikki, I don't know if this is just adrenaline or maybe body blindness, somehow mistakes Paolo for Dr. Arst, saying, oh, this is clearly, yes, Daniel Roebuck, and I think Rodrigo Santoro look exactly the same from behind. We get a fun moment here where Boone, with his season 3 hair, checks in to see if he has a pen. Nikki will unfortunately not be one of the people to provide the 8 pens to Boone as he's going out on this sort of like a Boy Scout mission for Jack. She finds Paolo sort of standing, is awestruck on the beach. And of course, the first thing she asks about is, where is the bag?
Where's the bag? Where are the diamonds?
And his shell shock. Yeah. And like, so he's focused more on like, what just happened? How are we alive? The PTSD, and she just wants.
But she's more about the BAG.
Yeah, she's like, I want that bag. Show me the bag. I'm here. She like Joe Mena. I'm here to secure the bag.
Exactly. And she'll have her own sort of little tactics to pull out as well later on. That might make her a good survivor player, or at least a very interesting one. And you know, there's a lot of, from a cinematography perspective, there's a lot of going to flashbacks by like focusing in on the apparently dead bodies of Nikki and Paolo. And we get it here as we get our first glimpse of present day Paolo, who is also lying in the jungle.
Is also
seemingly
dad.
Dead. He's his dad at this point. He has become Dr. Kincaid Esquire in full.
But this cracked me up. That cut, Mike, never fails to crack me up. Like it never fails to just like absolutely rip me up. That we go from Paolo being very, very alive to, yeah, I guess like sort of kind of alive.
Yeah, mostly dead,
but mostly
nearly dead,
but mostly dead, which I know there's a big difference between completely dead and mostly dead. But like, it's just so funny because this is the flashback structure and this is how the episode does it. Like we linger on their pseudo dead faces, and then we go back into the past, or we come back from the past and we come back to them just like lying on the ground. Yeah. These dead fish characters. So
well,
speaking of
dead fish, the person who apparently found Paolo is the fisherman of the group himself. Looks like Jin found Paolo while he was doing something in the jungle. He is joined by Hurley and Sawyer. Paolo is caught in a much weirder circumstance than Nikki. His pants are undone and his shoe is in a tree, and I think people are now looking for a net nearby to see if they were into some hanky-panky before, you know, all these mysterious circumstances happen. Jin, completely forgetting the events of season 1, immediately goes for Paolo's water bottle and starts to potentially go for the liquid, and Sawyer, though I will say, to Hurley's point, maybe Sawyer shouldn't have poured out the liquid, though I don't know what forensics they could have done on it. But yeah, Sawyer is very wise to point out, like, hey, something very clearly could have been in Paolo's water, so don't go messing with that stuff, Jimbo.
Yeah, yeah, don't touch that stuff. And that's when Sawyer's like, mm-mm, I don't think so.
He's suspecting some foul play here, yeah. Which again, this is just such a fun call forward to Sawyer the cop. Granted, he does not have his partner yet, and Miles Strom has yet to land on the island, or at least he has before, but is now going to be coming back to the island,
right.
Chronologically speaking. But so this is Sawyer sort of being on his own. Now we cut back once again to the night of White Rabbit. It's interesting, you know, Nikki and Paolo were talking about the monster, which makes sense because we get another cut here where Jin suspects the monster, cut to Nikki and Paolo saying it can't be the monster. At first, I thought this was going to be on night one when we get that infamous shot of, you know, all the main cast gathering to watch the tree shake. Seems like they're just sort of talking about it, even though it happened a few days ago. Instead, they are in the middle of the big Water Boone brouhaha, as Arts is sort of rallying the gawkers to throw the blame onto Boone. And Jack makes his only appearance in this episode, coming in to give the Live Together Die Alone speech. And we should also mention here, before
Ethan
that,
shows up.
Yeah,
Ethan's
Nikki and Paolo
here.
Are greeted by a very nice Wisconsin sweatshirt wearing Ethan Rom.
Wisconsin sweatshirt. Oh my
even
goodness.
Even though he's like, I wouldn't dare wear the shirt. I'm Canadian, so I don't even know what a Wisconsin is.
Yeah, yeah. It's
Ethan.
The cover
Ethan's
story
trying to,
is falling apart.
Yeah, he's trying to do his how do you do fellow kids type of mode by saying, like, exactly. Well, I lost my luggage, but I can help size
I
you
too
up.
Lost my luggage.
Consider me like the men's warehouse of 815, where I can find the perfect clothes for you.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Though he is sort of like the Garrick of Deep Space Nine in that variety, right? He's a tailor who has very seedy intentions. You can never tell where his loyalties lie. But yeah, I always found this moment like really stupid, but really funny to just have Nick to have Jack give his lips together dialogue speech and to cut to Nikki and Paolo just sort of standing there listening to it, like very Forrest Gumpian.
Very. And I don't know. I love seeing the live together dialogue. Like this was another thing for me in, and always is a thing for me in watching this episode. But especially now that this is the first time that I'm watching Lost on a weekly basis in forever. Is it's such a stark reminder this episode as we are barreling towards the end of Act One of the show that like even within this first act things have changed. People have grown up. People are very, very different. This may have only been like a month or 2 months ago in the real time of the drama. But think about Jack in this context versus right. Jack striking deals to get off the island. You know, there's a lot has happened with these characters. There's a great John Locke scene coming up that really demonstrates this idea. So this is a way in which I think that there's utility to seeing these moments from the past, as we're kind of just being reminded of like, it's like a stop down point. We're about halfway through. We're a little over halfway through at this point, as we've discussed. And it's nice to kind of reset like who we came with, who we're leaving with. We're not leaving quite yet. But we're moving on to the next phase, as Mikhail might say.
Yeah, I think that it's also a fun opportunity of like the seminal moments from season one in particular, right? Like this is what why we're having fun with the Lost RPG, which I know Josh and I, spoiler alert, have been talking offline as to this is the perfect opportunity to maybe ping the great R. Philly and see, you know, if he's up for doing some stuff. Because yeah. It's fun to imagine like how would these characters react to some of those bigger moments. You know, this really is, I know we compared it to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, but this is really like Lost Lower Decks in a manner of speaking, right? Where we're like cutting to characters who are not part of the main cast and see like, how are they reacting to all these missions that the A-team are going on to? We're going to get that more fleshed out with like their direct reactions to, for example, whatever the case may be. But it's fun to remember some of the big moments that happened in Lost Season 1 and how these different personalities might interact and react to them in a different capacity than some of those main characters that we're used to.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So, again, more monster talk takes us out of White Rabbit and onto the main island, where we have a short thing here where Hurley brings up the end of the cost of living. We bring up Mr. Echo's final words of "you're next" as to whether they meant the royal you or whether the monster essentially cursed Nikki and Paolo by essentially saying, like, no, you two specifically are next. Sawyer brings up, like, no, don't worry. He meant everybody. And Hurley's like, oh, that makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah, but I guess technically, like, Nikki and Paolo, at least we'll talk about it. Are they the monster's next victim? So
right, well, we'll talk about that. Sawyer quoting not the Black Rock but the Rock here by calling Nikki and Paolo jabonis.
Yeah, these jabronis over here.
Can you smell what Paolo is cooking? It smells like shaved truffle.
It's very truffly. It's like this very like pungent truffle smell.
We cut back. It was a very quick glimpse into the present as we go back into a flashback. And one of the things I do feel like, you know, there's a lot of Nikki plus Paolo, but I'm glad that they take some opportunities here to separate the characters again to make them very distinct. And here's for sound number three, we're going to get really the first glimpse of that in this episode as Nikki is going to engage with Dr. Arst, who in my opinion is one of the highlights of this episode. Let's listen to some foreshadowing conversation between the two.
Hey, Dr. Arst.
Oh, hi.
You're a scientist, right?
And an educator, yes.
What are you doing with all this stuff?
Oh, well, since we've got here, I've discovered 20 new species. I'm going to be the next Charles Darwin. Latrodectus regina. Very dangerous. They call her the Medusa spider. Her pheromones are very strong. One whiff and every male of the species would be here in seconds. Not unlike you, I guess.
So you're probably too busy to help me then.
No, not at all. I'm fine. I can help you. What can I do you for?
Well, I'm trying to find my luggage. And since the plane broke apart over the jungle, I was wondering if you knew about trajectories and stuff.
Do I know about trajectories? Allow me to draw you a map, madame.
I love ours so much. Let me draw you a map, madame.
Madame. I'm of two minds, Mike. Mind number one is seeing Arst again here makes me so sad that they killed him off so early in the show. But then mind number two is like, yeah, but they killed him off perfectly.
I just
wish that like there had been more occasions to like sprinkle him liberally throughout the show. Ultimately, he probably is just used perfectly.
I think for Arst, it's like a little bit goes a long way, right? It's like a be careful what you wish for, because I think when you ask for more characters, then we sort of get overloaded with them. Because I think that the dosages of Arst that we get is fantastic. I love how we get so hot under the collar or hot under the ascot for Nikki. It's very clear, like, I mean, Nikki is one to definitely employ flirtation as a strategy, which again would make her a very interesting survivor player. She knows how Arst seemingly leers after her, and so she uses that to her advantage. I can imagine walking up to him in her bathing suit probably helps that. I'm going to throw out a hot take here, Josh. Maybe in an alternate universe, if there is no Saeed on Oceanic 815, Leslie Arst might be a suitable substitute. This dude seemingly knows a lot about everything. He's going from like giving typifying the species of spiders to drawing out a pitch perfect trajectory for her.
Oh my god. Yeah, but he's the worst.
He's the worst, but he knows so much seemingly, which, I mean, granted, like, I would love to have Dr. Arst as a science teacher personally. You're going to learn so much cool stuff with him, as opposed to, like, not to besmirch the science teachers I personally had, but Josh, I cannot imagine many high school science teachers know about, you know, prevailing winds, yeah, know about spider species.
But it's all about communications, right? And in that regard, he's a total butthead. He's a weenus. He's a dweeb. He can't, he's so crotchety.
Which is probably why he teaches high school instead of, you know, moving up to be a college professor.
Like, you hear anything about him and he's very surly towards absolutely everyone. He was surly on the security line. You know, the only helpful thing we ever saw him do is help Claire with her luggage. Like, he's like, seems to be like kind of a nasty dude.
Oh, he does help. At least he helps Nikki a little bit here. He unintentionally gives her the idea behind the
mission. Why, right? Like, why is he helping Nikki here is the question. And like, he makes that,
I think. Well, Arst is horny. We can say that.
Yeah, you know, so like, I guess
thirsty.
Like,
he's so thirsty, and it's not just because Boone took the water.
So is Saeed Jarrah. But I think Saeed Jarrah plays well with others in a way that Dr. Arst simply does not.
Just really want to imagine alternate universe watch where it's like Arst being like, we've got to go to the tower and get a radio signal.
Yeah. I also served in the war. Oh, yeah? Were you a Marine? You were. No, I was a warrior for the Worcester Warriors.
Yeah, I was gonna say like, oh, I put a lot of time on Civ 5.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, let's go climb the Black Rock, madam.
Yeah, maybe in another universe, he was playing MMORPGs with John Locke.
That would be fun. Yeah, like Darwin 69 is crushing me. Who
Darwin
is this guy?
69.
So it turns out that Arst's trajectory map brings Nikki and Paolo to the Beechcraft, to the location of the Pearl, where, surprise, surprise here, they're able to find the hatch going down into the Pearl. We get a little bit of like conflict between the two where Paolo is not particularly happy that Nikki is sort of turning on the charm to get something out of Arst. I think that he is beginning to see what he is going to muse a couple of times over the rest of the episode, which is like, wow, if she can do that for these guys very easily, what does that say about her sincere feelings towards me? Nikki immediately tries to boon Paolo here and says, hey, why don't you go climb up into that plane and see exactly what the deal is there? But Paolo immediately refuses. He is not going
to
be booned in that variety.
That way lies death. And,
yeah, exactly. Like, maybe a radio is up there, but we'll get one later on. But they indeed find the long, dark hatch down into the Pearl, which Nikki, she's up. She's all about going up, but not necessarily going down. Josh, I don't know if this is a hot take. My least favorite part of this episode is the inclusion of the Pearl in here. Maybe it's because like there's so much season one packed in here, and again, my heart warms so much for the season one stuff that I want to focus on that, but I always found their choice to like include the Pearl stuff in here just felt a little out of whack to me.
Yeah, I think it's again sort of in line with like getting like, so you get to the end of the episode and Hurley buries people alive. And so canonically, Hurley has killed Nikki and Paolo, right? Like Hurley is a participant in the not the murder, but the manslaughter, at least.
Yeah, like the unintentional murder.
Yeah, I don't know what Dr. Kincaid Esquire would have to say about that. But, you know, it's not great. And so canonically, Nikki and Paolo discovered the pearl before John and Echo did. And so it's like another way of being like, yeah, but these stories weren't worth telling because they weren't interested in any of the shit in there. They weren't going to do it. This is like, we're telling you the stories of the people that are doing the things that are driving the drama. Like these people, this is a Ronnie and Billy story, you know, like they find the pearl and then instead like Ronnie has the farts. And so they have to run back into the forest when they don't realize that there's a toilet beneath them. If they were just a little more curious, you know, like they like that, that's the story that they're telling here. So I get if it's not totally your thing, but for me, I think as that meta commentary is being driven further, it's this idea of like, just look at just how aggravating this is.
Right.
That these two jabronis, that these also like arse, these fellow buttheads, these arseholes, are so close to mythology and yet have no interest at all. They have no curiosity about their surroundings. Like Jacob is shaking in his freshly weaved tapestry.
Right, exactly. It's like, oh, look at all these TV screens that spy on other parts of the island. But no, we got to find some place to put diamonds. Let's choose the toilet.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think maybe for me, it's this idea of I find so much of the appeal of these flashbacks is like, again, watching them interact to moments that we have already seen. And maybe them sort of striking off on their own and having their own sort of moments maybe takes away that appeal for me because that's distinctly different. But I do see what you're talking about of like sort of underlying the fact of like, yeah, they had this golden opportunity in front of them and they didn't even take it. And that just proves how bad these characters are.
Yeah.
So now we cut back here. Paolo's going to like look lingeringly despite Nikki refusing to go down the hatch, as it were. And we cut back to Charlie, Hurley, and Sawyer. Surprise, surprise, shoes on the other foot here and not in a tree for James Ford here, as he is now rifling through someone else's stuff. Mm-hmm. He's going through Paolo's tent here.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of discoveries in this little clip as the trio soon find out that there's more to Nikki and Paolo than meets the eye.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Hey, man, be careful.
Why? They don't live here anymore.
So, son, check the food. They're eating the same as us and no one else is sick. Could be a virus.
Dude. Monster.
Creepy, they collected bugs?
I think these were artists. Collected all kinds of different creepy crawlies before he exploded.
They must have been friends.
Expose.
Did you just say expose?
Yeah.
What the hell's expose?
It's gonna be the most awesome hour of television ever. It's like Baywatch, only better. It's about Autumn and Crystal, two strippers that solve crimes with the help of their suave, smooth-talking club owner, Mr. Lashad.
I missed that one.
Check it out. Look at the cast list. Nikki Fernandez. That's gotta be what she was in Australia. This must have been her big break.
Certainly sounds like it.
No way. Mr. Lashad was the Cobra?
Is that supposed to mean something?
Dude, the Cobra's this big bad guy. His identity's been shrouded in mystery for 4 seasons. They had a walkie-talkie?
Every damn one of those bastards on the other side of the island had one exactly like this hanging from their belts.
So how did Nikki and Paolo get one?
I'll tell you how. They were working with the others.
Well, actually, actually, sir, I believe you mean the other island instead of the other side of the island, mm-hmm. since you do not canonically know about the barracks.
Yeah, have you forgotten all about the barracks, sir? There's so much here. Hurley just like wearing his nerd card on his sleeve about expose.
Well, also Dominic Monaghan sort of wearing his nerd card as well, and him handling that little jar of bugs too, knowing mm-hmm. what he's going to go on to do.
Yeah, you know, he's got his nature program that he's heading towards.
All those creepy crawlies.
Uh-huh. But for Hurley, him talking about how the Cobra has been shrouded in mystery for four seasons. You know, this is akin to setting up that the bad guy, like the ultimate bad guy of Lost, has kind of been hiding in plain sight. Right. Yep. Like this idea that, you know, whether it was Ben, but that, you know, that was a pretty short lived mystery.
And specifically this idea that like someone you thought was working. I mean, this essentially is sort of like foreshadowing the entire post-Ajira arc in season 5, right?
Exactly.
That, like, the person that we think is this character that we all know and love is actually the big bad who has been planning everything behind the scenes.
Right. Exactly. And so like they managed to like sort of like map that idea onto, and you have to think that at this point they're close to like unlocking that idea about unlock, right? Like you think that because they know that there's going to be somebody in a casket by the end of season 3. You can argue whether or not they know who's in the casket yet at that point, but I think like seeds of that idea and what they want to do with John Locke versus Jack, or and like sort of like spiritually John Locke and Jack, right? Like I feel like a lot of those ideas must be like swirling around as destination points. It's just like exactly how do we get there and how do we render it. But this whole thing with the Cobra actually does very effectively foreshadow this idea that the bad guy, like who is responsible for all of this, is part and parcel with a question that we've been asking incorrectly all the way up to this point and beyond this point, is what is the smoke monster, when you should be asking who is the smoke monster? So I love it. I think that, you know, again, this is just me putting my own nerd hat on. But I think that there's a lot of fun to be had in just like all of the metatextual stuff in the episode.
What do you think happened to Exposé after all this? Because the creator died, and then one of the guest stars died in a plane crash. I mean, I guess reruns were still on at least, because as we talked about, David Reyes is going to be watching it. But do you actually think like season 4 ended up getting put out there?
Yeah, I would expect so. I feel like as long as it was like, you know, if the rights are with a studio rather than with Howie, you know, and if it really is as beloved a franchise as everybody says, if the show ended on that cliffhanger of Billy Dee being the Cobra, people would be pissed.
Well, I don't know how far after the first and second scenes in the flashback take place. You know, if that indeed was the last episode they shot before Howard Zuckerman died, that would have been crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd like to see the end of Exposé. I think
it would have been like the end of the Super Mario Brothers movie, right? Where like they burst in like, oh my God, it's this thing that we need to take care of in the next movie that's definitely happening. And then the next movie definitely doesn't happen.
You just reminded me of how Super Mario Brothers the movie ended. I'm like, wait, how did it? It's like, oh yeah, Daisy shows back up.
Yeah,
right?
Daisy's like, oh, we got to go do this thing. And they're like, great, let's get into action for the movie that we'll never actually conceptualize. So let's go back here to, speaking of another beloved piece of pop culture, Josh, let's talk about whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we get a flashback and we see like Boone and Shannon and Arst reading Kate for filth, like they want to know everything.
Yeah, and I guess we talked about this during season 1 as to like how the case of guns was very, at least from our perspective, very privately held information, right? Like to the point where Locke only found out during homecoming on a need-to-know basis. Otherwise, though, it seems like somebody's been flapping their gums, because now we have a bunch of like pseudo gawkers coming up to Kate and being like, why didn't you tell us about the guns?
Is this happening around homecoming, maybe?
It's day 33, so I'm trying to remember what that is in the timeline.
All right, so Lost, day 33, a quick Google search. You can't really look it up that way. So Lost, homecoming.
While you figure that out, I'll talk through what happens here. So essentially, Nikki and Paolo are brought in here. Everyone complains about how Kate, Jack,
this is,
and Sawyer.
This is, if it's day 33.
Yep.
It's post homecoming.
Okay, so Ethan is dead. Man, the guy who in the Wisconsin sweatshirt was another.
Yeah, so homecoming has happened at this point.
Okay, so that's that at least implicates Kate a little bit here, and that people are finding out more about the guns because they were necessary.
In the middle of Ooh in Translation, which takes place on days 32 to 34.
Okay, so they're like, well, the Roft burned. Let's see if we can go to the waterfall and acquire the diamonds here. Because basically, once they heard about where the case was, Nikki and Paolo go to the waterfall. This is when Paolo, I'd imagine that these feelings have sort of been brewing in him for some time, but he finally comes right out and asks, like, hey, you know, if it wasn't just for the bag, would you still be with me? But Nikki is, again, fully concentrated on the bag. She brings up that the diamonds are worth $8 million, which, listen, maybe this is a little bit of, like, Austin Powers-esque on our part. Honestly, doesn't seem like much to really kill people over.
Well, here's the thing about the diamonds, Mike. They're clearly fake. They are so light, right? Like they look like stage diamonds. They look like props. They don't look real.
So do you think, is this Howie getting one over on Nikki? Is this someone getting one over on Howie?
I like to think that Nikki and Paolo are so bad at crime that they took Howie's fake diamonds.
I like that. And
guess Sawyer believes that they're real. You're not going to get one over on Sawyer.
Right, because that was one of the hustles that he ran, right, during the Cassidy episode. We're going to get to that later on.
He's just blaming on the prop master.
The prop note that I had later on was the diamonds that Sawyer is going to pour on Nikki and Paolo are different than the diamonds that we're going to see a couple times in those close-up shots look much more like, I don't know, like sugar crystals, like uncut diamonds, uncut gems, if you will.
Rock candy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the ones that Sawyer are going to pour on top at the end there are like very finished diamonds. So it's very, unless Sawyer is a jeweler himself, that seems really weird.
Yeah. He's bobbed and weaved throughout that industry. So maybe he would know. This might be a good time to read one of the most ridiculous pieces of feedback we've ever received on Down the Hatch. Let me see.
Wow, that is saying something.
It's pretty great. It's pretty great. Hold on. I gotta access the official Down the Hatch email account to dig it up. This is from the great essayist Riley Wigmore. I will read in full. Riley writes in. So the smoke monster is known for taking many forms, whether human or possibly animal. And does so to mess with and possibly kill some of the survivors. I know it's a theory that the smoke monster is the Medusa spider that gets Nikki. But my question is, can the smoke monster take the form of an inanimate object? And if he can, would he take the form of a lost inanimate object that would lead to people on the island going crazy over them and becoming desperate and acting rashly? Those diamonds did look pretty fake. What if that was because the smoke monster was the diamonds?
Ooh, I love this theory. It's totally in my wheelhouse in terms of being out of the box. So we're talking like Wonder Twins here, right? Where like the smoke monster can take the form of living objects, but also can take the form of like a shape of water, right?
But this is like the line from Captain Marvel when Talos is like, I'm on the team. And they're talking to Talos, and they're asking him about all the things that you can turn into. He's like, every Skrull can do it, but it requires a little practice and, dare I say, some talent. And then they're like, could you turn into a filing cabinet? He goes, why would I turn into a filing cabinet?
Yeah,
I think
so maybe
that's probably the smoke monster here.
It's not a question of if you can, it's whether you should.
It's like, why would I turn into some diamonds here? But even I, the man who is constantly holding up the moth and asking if it's a smoke monster, I cannot hold up this bag of diamonds and assume it's the smoke monster.
Would the smoke monster be the bag and each individual diamond? Is it one diamond? Is it the bag?
Man. I don't know.
We've talked about this as to whether the smoke monster can like divide itself. So we might need a little bit refining on it, but I would love that if it's like, you know, Treasure of the Sierra Madre style. If this is what they're fighting over and it turns out it's just the smoke monster. Because I don't think, are Nikki and Paolo candidates? I know this is my own sort of moth question, but if they're not, this is just them effing with like rando people.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. I don't know if a crossed out Fernandez is anywhere on.
Yeah, or just Paolo because he has no last name. It's like Cher.
Yeah, Escaton. I don't know if that exists.
So we cut back because now, obviously, Sawyer is on a new, he's got a new path he's sniffing down right now, the bloodhound that he is, that he now believes, considering that there is precedent that someone like Michael had been turned by the others before, they are discussing the legitimate possibility that Nikki and Paolo are working with the others. You know, Hurley sort of counters like, no, this wouldn't be the case. But Sun brings up like, oh, well, others have been in our camp before, not even talking about Ethan. Remember when I was kidnapped by the others right here in camp? Cue, you know, very guilty looks from Charlie in particular. Sawyer kind of doesn't give an F. Sawyer's like, I'm going to go do a perimeter sweep. Mm-hmm. And he grabs a gun, which Hurley questions him about. He's seen expose, but apparently not enough cop shows to know what a perimeter sweep is. And while Charlie and Son cover up the bodies, Charlie is going to uncover some stuff very soon.
Yeah. He's going to reveal some skeletons from his own closet, which is another thing that I think this episode does, is it doesn't just acknowledge the mistakes of Nikki and Paolo, but maybe some of the other assassinations of character along the way.
Exactly. Like, oh, we're in the past now. Charlie will literally say, I was a different man. I was season two. Charlie.
They were writing me weird. It wasn't my fault.
Yeah, and a little bit of, like, previous Sawyer as well, right? Like, we find out that Sawyer has a gun that he took that Paolo had on him. Hurley's starting to become leery of Sawyer. We're going to get into later on of, like, being suspicious of Sawyer, which is, like, the first season Sawyer of him being so off on his own, doing a bunch of shady stuff. So this is not only a flashback for these two characters, but for some of these good and bad qualities of characters in the past as well.
Yeah.
All right, so we cut to, I want to say, sometime later than the last time. I think it's like day 49, I want to say. But Paolo, Paolo came up from the water at the waterfall and said, oh, there's nothing down there but dead bodies. There was not. I think the first clue we should have gotten was the fact that it was a script bag for expose, and there was a script from expose that Hurley leafed through. That was probably the first clue that the bag would eventually be found. Paolo has found the bag. He's digging into his nicotine gum, and he is trying to... He's digging a hole, which, again, is going to be foreshadowing for what happens to him and ruminating as to what to do with the Russian doll. And he has happened upon, not by Nikki, but by another individual who is harboring his own secrets. This is a short and sweet conversation between Paolo and John Locke.
Nice night. What you doing?
Nothing.
It looks like you're digging a hole.
Every man's entitled to his secrets, Paolo, but can I give you a piece of advice?
Please, John.
You should put the shovel away and save yourself some trouble.
Why is that?
Things don't stay buried on this island. The beach is eroding. Winter's coming, high tide. Whatever it is you're hiding, make sure you pick a spot that won't wash away. See you back at camp.
All right, I got to call out Locke's another Wikipedia fact check here for John Locke, because winter in the South Pacific is very different from winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Actually, it would be summer in the South Pacific, so not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, but he could also, there's a couple of things to say about this. One is he could be a big fan of George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, which is published through, I think, at this point, I don't know if A Feast for Crows is published or about to be published.
Speaking of another type of book series that splits up focus between multiple characters.
And just to put that in perspective, so either book four of A Song of Ice and Fire has been or is just about to be released by the time that the lost characters have crashed on the island. And to this date, in 2020, only one additional book has been released. So
wow.
Just to put all of that in perspective, George! So there's that. The other thing could be that Locke just like thinks like it's a good metaphor and he could just drop it on Paolo, and also like doesn't think that Paolo is gonna like challenge him on it because he's betting like he doesn't know that it's winter or not, so it's just like Locke doing Locke things. Could also just be he legitimately doesn't know, because Locke often poses as an expert, but as we've fact checked, gets things wrong. very frequently. So I think a few options on the board. This is day 49, which means this is what John Locke is up to during Collision. So this, if it's the night of day 49, then it means he's on his way back from the hatch, where he and Mr. Echo have just watched the missing reel of footage from the
where they were told, don't go and type in the computer because you'll get dad back.
Right. Yeah. So exactly. So you'll get dad. So he, at this point, is coming to Paulo with his faith rewarded. A secret of the island has unburied itself very recently.
Yeah, and this is also, like, I even think before the hatch stuff, this is very in character for John Locke, right? He himself, who carries a big secret that he will only reveal to a select few people. Like, he's basically like, no, everything doesn't need to be out in the open. Every man's entitled to his secrets, Paulo, but do yourself a favor and, like, keep your hands clean. You know, like, if you're gonna be super secretive about stuff, don't get caught doing it, is essentially the advice that Locke gives to Paulo.
Yes.
And that is going to drive Paulo to go back, or for the first time, I suppose, down the hatch into the Pearl, and specifically into the bathroom of the Pearl as he places the Russian doll in the toilet tank.
Yes.
But he is not alone, as we hear a voice off camera chastise a derelict other for leaving one of the TV screens on, as it's Ben and Juliet coming here. This is obviously before the events of one of them, before Ben places himself undercover. They are ruminating over what to do with Jack Shepard, who is on the screen right now. There's a, you know, Juliet says he's cute, and it's part tongue-in-cheek and part them really underlining that love quadrangle. And Ben outright says what he does. I find out what he's emotionally invested in, and I exploit it.
Yeah. So this is about, so if it's day 49, so this is somewhere in the window of 10 days between now and Ben getting caught in the net. So, you know, we don't know exactly when Paulo is in the Pearl Station hiding the thing. It could be, you know, the day after. It could be day 50. Either way, they're like about like a week plus from Ben getting caught is how far back Ben is thinking about the Michael stuff, because Michael has just been captured, basically, or he's just about to be captured.
Right, because the hunting party is the episode before one of them.
Yeah, so it's, I think it's...
Or no, no, then no, the fire, yeah, fire plus
yeah,
water. And then.
So if this is happening around the time of the hunting party and they've just caught Michael, then it's days 51 to 52. So they've got some time to be here and to start formulating that plan.
Yeah, but they're so concentrated on that that it does seem like they leave a walkie-talkie behind, which will now we know that, oh, it's all a big misunderstanding, which will be the theme of this episode in the end, that, you know, the walkie-talkie was just sort of Paulo holding onto it, much like many of his secrets. I want to stop down here for a second, Josh, to go into sound number six, because we do this sometimes, but very rarely on Down the Hatch. Sound number six is going to be sound from a deleted scene from this episode. This was a very last minute pivot. I initially had the Ben Juliet talk in here, but upon watching this deleted scene, which was called People Can Change from this episode, you know, we're going to get a Nikki and Paulo conversation later on that I think hammers home their dynamic and how they feel about spending their lives on the island. But there's another really interesting scene between the two of them that unfortunately hit the cutting room floor. So let me set this up a bit. So People Can Change is another flashback. It takes place following or during the Purple Sky incident. So the first, it's like a 3.5 minute clip. I won't play the first minute and a half because it's Nikki reacting to the Purple Sky. We see Bernard, which made me realize, Josh, that Rose and Bernard have been absent from season 3 up to this point. I didn't even realize that. But essentially, Nikki is shell-shocked from this, much like Paulo was on day 1. She is all out of sorts with what happened with the Purple Sky. And Paulo is going to sit down and talk with her. And remembering, you know, where they are in the context of everything, Paulo has now has the diamonds, but is keeping them safe and secret from Nikki. This is the conversation that they're going to have. Sound number six.
It's fine, Nikki. We're okay.
No, Paulo, we're not okay. If you didn't notice, this guy just turned purple.
I know, but it's back now. It's back.
everything's all right.
No, it's not.
Look at me. Take a deep breath. Here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna take a walk down the beach, look for the bag, bring a picnic lunch, and forget all about whatever there was. Okay?
I don't wanna look anymore.
What are you talking about?
You know the day of the crash, Paolo? When people were dying all around us? And I found you and you were alive. You know what my first thought was? I hope he has the bag. And that is so wrong, and I don't want to be that person anymore.
You're a good person, Nikki.
No, I'm not. And you put up with me this whole time. You deserve better.
Okay, Nikki.
What we have to do, we have to start making friends with people in camp, you know?
What? They don't want anything to do with us. They never have.
That's our fault. I mean, we kept to ourselves. We can't do that anymore. We have to start caring about them.
I thought you said you'd rather die alone.
I've changed. I don't want to die. Stupid
man. Okay. Then we won't.
Really?
Really?
Oof!
Yeah. It's a really interesting. And I'll be honest, Josh, I kind of wish it made the episode.
No, I totally disagree.
Really?
I could not disagree harder. That they have to have a scene that explains why they haven't been hanging out with everybody is ridiculous. Hanging out where no one knows who we are. We've been keeping to ourselves. Like, I don't need anything like that. And in fact, I think you throw this into Exposé, and I think it really dilutes what Exposé succeeds at, which is just making this like a cartoon. Effectively, this is like, it's like an animated episode of Lost almost. It's just like a total lark. The second that you really try to humanize these characters in this way, I think that that is now trying to have your cake and eat it too, and they really can't afford to do that. I even just listening to this, I just had douche chills. Like, it just did not feel right to me at all. Like, Nikki, we can go down, we'll have a picnic, we'll forget all about
it. Listen, it was bad on Paolo's part to assume that they'd have a picnic, considering that is the kiss of death.
I'll shave truffles, like, I'll do it, I got all this.
You were off on the wrong foot as soon as they mentioned the purple sky, and Paolo said, it doesn't matter, it's okay now.
Yeah, look at it, it's turned black. Oh god, it's night. No, I'm out on this. Fully could not be more hard out on that scene.
I think you're out on
them way too much.
Well, that's the thing. You're out on it for a really interesting reason, because I'm in on it because I think Nikki is terrible in this episode. And I'm grateful that there's at least a little glimpse of her being somewhat guilty of her actions. Granted, like you said, does it take away from the two-dimensional cartoon villain-esque shading? Perhaps, but also as someone who doesn't want to completely hate Nikki for a 42-minute episode, I'm grateful for that at least.
Yeah, no, I want to hate Nikki and Paolo. You know,
wow.
Like, I think that the second that they try to, like, you know, this episode apologizes for the unmitigated gall of trying to have two 815ers from the background become series regulars three seasons into the game. And I think if they are trying to dimensionalize them in any way other than this was a mistake and we're sorry, and to have them as mistakes underlining the ways in which the rest of the show is so great, I think that's a huge tactical error. So even if that wasn't my main point, I would also say I think that's just the way that the dialogue goes, and that, like, it feels very weak. It feels like a weak scene to me. I'm really glad that they had the wherewithal to delete that. I think it does not deserve to belong in Exposé, and if that is in Exposé, I think it's a bad enough scene that it diminishes my views of Exposé because
the lone thing to bring down.
Lone thing to bring it down, but I think it changes Exposé significantly.
I see, in my opinion, I think it is a fine scene to use in Lost, not a good scene to use in Exposé. That's where I would settle. I think if you put two other characters in here and we put her in an episode of Lost, you're like, great, this is a great way to humanize these characters. But to your point, if the purpose in Exposé is to completely bury these characters, for lack of a better term, we do not need moments to make them fully three-dimensional.
Absolutely not.
So we cut back to the present, and hey, Desmond's making an appearance in this episode.
So Desmond is hysterical here. I believe it was April who said that she watches Exposé as a standout often, and that this watch of Exposé for April in rewatching, like, there's just like different lines that stand out for her, and for her this time. It's Hurley comes up to Desmond and asks if he's heard that Nikki and Paolo have died, and Desmond totally deadpans, "Aye, tragic." April says, "I don't know why, but I completely lost it. This man is doing the absolute most to save Charlie's life over and over again, but he couldn't give a crap about Nikki and Paolo, and it is fantastic." My favorite line from this is when Desmond tells Hurley, like, "I saw her earlier today with your mate," and Hurley goes, "My mate?" And Desmond goes, "Aye, ya boy, Sawyer."
Yeah. Hey, it's ya boy, Sawyer.
Ya boy, Sawyer is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, so basically, to yada yada through this scene, Hurley, this is now the part of the procedural where, like, they try to enlist help from, like, their expert. In this case, it's Desmond saying, "Hey, use your freaky psychic powers to figure out what happened." But Desmond says, "Doesn't work that way, brother." And Hurley sort of chastises Desmond, saying he has, quote, a pretty weak superpower. But Desmond does feed Hurley's fire of suspicion against Sawyer by saying that your boy was talking to Nikki earlier today, and if he's denying that he knows her, that's a little sus. Meanwhile, Vincent is being a bit of a troll and uncovering the bodies. Well, actually, not a troll, because he's making sure that Nikki and Paolo are breathing, because they are indeed alive.
There
and they
is a push. There's been a push to get Vincent an MVP point this episode. And I'm looking at our MVP points, and I don't know where we give that. But I think that there is a very strong argument that Vincent is the only one trying to save Nikki and Paolo, because Vincent knows. I do think Vincent probably deserves an MVP point here.
If the show doesn't want to save Nikki and Paolo, then why do we give credit to Vincent for trying to do so?
I guess that's a fair point. All right, no MVP point for
Vincent. By your logic, then, by like the deleted scene logic, Vincent should get an LVP point for trying to save their lives.
I mean, I think what Vincent is doing is good. I think it's better that he fails. But I think what Vincent's trying to do is worthy of an MVP point, and it is better that he fails. Success. Victory is not the ultimate marker of success.
Right. Moral victory if Vincent's able to do so. But it's also delaying the inevitable I don't know. It's a sort of, would you rather be asphyxiated by a blanket or get buried alive is a real fine line.
I don't
know
that I want to be asphyxiated by anything.
I mean, you don't get a choice. You're paralyzed.
I guess.
But Hurley essentially takes his findings back to Charlie and Son. Son is still in the pro-Sawyer camp saying, like, no, it was the others who kidnapped me. While Hurley leaves to sort of assert his own matters, Charlie finally says, "Yeah, I remember that episode, The Long Con. Yeah, that was actually
me. Sorry, Son, I did that. The character writing on me last year was just really out of whack. If I could do it over, I wouldn't do any of that."
Yeah, but a little bit gets shunted off onto Sawyer, right? He sort of finishes his confession by saying, "But also, it was Sawyer's idea. I was his stooge." I wonder, Josh, how much of the whole Charlie's death clock concept plays into this, right? Is this him sort of like, you know, making amends in the past that he knows that he's sort of like on the way out?
He's in a better place right now, even as he's in a scary place right now. Like, I think, like, he's in a very scary place right now, but it's not quite as dark as where he was. Because right now he feels, like, back then he didn't feel like he had much worth living for. Right now he does. And so the idea of his imminent mortality, like, I think that is very frightening for him. So I think that's a piece of it. But I also do think that this is like an episode that wants to be all apologies for things that, like, the show feels like it's done poorly at this point. And I'm sure that there's a lot more that they would apologize for. But within the context of Exposé and the character combinations that they have, these are the apologies that make sense to issue at this moment in time in the language of the show. And so for Charlie to stand up and do this, I think is like the writers acknowledging to a degree that like, yeah, the season two Charlie storyline is not our favorite.
I would also call this almost like least hits for Charlie instead of greatest hits, where I can imagine he's sort of like making the rounds and he's realizing some of the his favorite memories. They're also reminders of some of his worst memories. And, you know, we are composites of our memories. Sometimes we need to acknowledge the bad with the good. I can imagine him sort of going through Charlie Pace, This Is Your Life. Oh, yeah, I did that. I kidnapped this woman and she is really beating the drum that the others did this. I cannot die without letting her know what the truth is.
Yeah,
the whole truth, that is.
The whole truth. Yeah, I think that there's pieces of that there for sure. Like I think like he's more contemplative right now. You know, I think that he's a man looking down into the abyss, and he doesn't want to go without regret.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie's case up to this point had been taking on water, much like the toilet tank. Where we now cut to the events of Further Instructions. We sort of get a replay of now we understand why Paolo was so shaken when Nikki, taking up the attitude that she talked about at the end of the deleted scene, is like, oh no, let's just be like gung-ho about the group. I'm done looking for the diamonds. Paolo realizes that they are going to the Pearl, which is not a good idea. And now we see the other side of the Paolo takes a shit scene, where essentially Paolo is takes apart the dolls. He Virgin Mary statue style just curb stomps the last one of them and crotch idles the diamonds, Josh.
Mm-hmm. It was in my pants.
Exactly. The diamonds are in my pants.
They're in my pants.
You don't want to touch this, Richard Alpert. But then to cover up the tracks, Paolo just, in my opinion, I don't know, maybe a plumber can follow up about this, completely destroys the toilet by putting all the broken remnants of all the Russian dolls back in there and flushing it.
Mm-hmm. The toilet still works, or worked.
Yeah,
not anymore.
And I'm trying to remember, Josh, is this the last time we see the Pearl? I can't remember.
I don't recall going to the Pearl after this. It doesn't come to mind.
Yeah.
I don't believe we do.
Yeah, so this is a wrap on the Pearl, as Paolo clogging the toilet.
We are. We see the roof of the Pearl. We see the beach craft again, at least twice that I can think of, but I cannot recall going into the Pearl another time.
Yeah, so I guess that's a wrap on the image, the interior
of the
Pearl.
Both the diamonds and the Pearl.
Yeah, exactly. It's many pieces of jewelry go bye-bye in this episode, and so does the Pearl, which I guess is maybe another sort of burial of loss as well. Like, not to say, I don't think the Pearl was a failure, because it really informs John Locke's decisions in the last parts of season two, but I don't know, maybe the writers were not too keen on using it as a concept, so they were fine getting rid of it here.
Yeah, maybe.
So going back here, finally the confrontation occurs. Hurley essentially tells Sawyer everything that he knows. I love Sawyer does like a real grave stare at Desmond when he finds out that Desmond essentially snitched on him.
Yeah, because Sawyer and Desmond don't have a lot of moments together over the course of the show. They're very few and far between. I think there's one coming up next week, and I think that that's like basically it. So Sawyer and Desmond never really get the chance to truly like grow out.
Well, plus Sawyer went to prison, right? He knows the stitch code. And yeah. So it like he's very unhappy.
So did Desmond.
That's actually very true, but maybe it's different in the UK. Maybe they're more,
I don't know.
They're more proper about everything, but Sawyer basically comes clean, with his dirty fingernails. He basically says, like, the reason why I was keeping this secret is I noticed that when Charlie brought up the gunk under his fingernails, that it was dirt. It means she was digging for something. This is what she was digging for. And he hands over the diamonds, no matter how they look. And it looks like a little bit of selfish Sawyer peeking through here as he reveals, like, yeah, I kept this a secret because I wanted to hoard these $8 million diamonds for myself.
Yeah, he's like, what happens if we do get out of here? You know, it'd be nice. Nice to have.
And Hurley's like, dude, you could have just asked for a loan.
I know. Yeah. There's a scene in Succession where the Roys are like dunking on cousin Greg, who is like, yeah, well, when my grandpa dies, he's going to leave me everything. That's like $4 million. And I'll be able to you know, live for the rest of my life on that. And the Roys are like, $4 million. You're like the weakest person in the rich room. That's like what Hurley is all but able to say to Sawyer in this moment. It's like, oh, $8 million. Woo! Look at this guy.
Dodson, like, we got $8 million here. See, nobody cares.
Screw you guys. Screw you guys so hard. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, hang on to the diamonds. You've come this far, Sawyer. I feel like your reputation has already taken a hit.
Yeah, well, and it's also a thing of, like, it's two steps forward and one step back for him, where, like, he has made some concessions to Hurley's point several weeks ago. He has earned the points. He is now sort of getting dunked on in a ping-pong fashion, but has sort of now made friends on the island separate from Kate and Jack. But he's still Sawyer at the end of the day, and so he can't help but sort of dive into the man that he's been or tried to be for so long, and that includes being super squirrely between taking a gun from Paolo and stealing the diamonds without needing to let everyone know about the plan.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's cut to a Nikki and Paolo scene that is probably more palatable from Josh's point of view. Yeah. Exactly, in that it made the episode and therefore probably does not humanize these characters in a bit. Nikki and Paolo decide to ruminate about their varying perspectives about things now that, at least from one perspective, the hope of rescue seems nigh. Again, let's remember, Nikki thinks the diamonds are a foregone conclusion. Paolo obviously does not. But here's where the two characters are standing at this point in time. Or sitting, because they're in the sand.
Did you know Thanksgiving was 2 weeks ago? We missed it, Paolo, just like we're going to miss everything.
You're going to find us. We'll get rescued. You'll see.
Okay, where did this sudden burst of optimism come from?
I know, I guess. That's how we look at things. Like the bag. I mean, maybe not finding it was good for us.
How do you figure that?
Look what it did. It might have torn us apart. Some breakfast.
Okay.
But Paolo isn't saying wait here to Nikki. He's saying wait here to his pack of nicotine gum.
Yeah, which he's leaving behind in the sand. And so the reason why I like this scene a lot better, which I think is getting quicker to the notes that are played in that deleted scene, Mike, is that there is still intrigue here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're still following the line of these extremely shitty people, like, even in a nice moment, are going to hard turn towards extremely shitty
right,
again.
Right, that's the thing is that Nikki has now sort of, she's come to acceptance, right, in the grieving process.
Uh-huh.
She's like, we won't find the bag, I'm good. And then as soon as she finds the gum, it's going to make
proof
her
of life, and she's like, oh, Paolo.
Oh, well, good. I'm
oh,
making a beeline.
Son of a bitch.
Making a beeline or a spider line for yeah. that Medusa spider. I should also yeah. mention here, because we hear a little bit of credit where credit is due in the episode, and to go a bit into the Jim Fells of it all. So this episode, true to the theming of it, calls back a lot of season one motifs. Like, for example, when Kate and Saeed talk about climbing up the hill, we hear that motif in this episode. We hear the plane crash motif again. So there really are about calling back to things in many different ways. But yeah, Nikki's mood definitely turns as soon as she sees that nicotine gum. And it cuts to
Nikki
her
team.
Immediately approaching Sawyer. This is the conversation that Desmond heard between Nikki and your boy,
Sawyer.
Where Nikki, you know, basically asks, like, give me a gun. Sawyer essentially brushes her off, tells her to go stick her head in the ocean to cool off for a while. And Nikki's final words to Sawyer are, thanks for nothing, which he says to her as he begins to dig the grave here.
Yeah.
And as Sun is stumbling upon Sawyer digging his grave, she's going to prevent him from digging his own grave in another perspective. She is going to, quote-unquote, confront him about the kidnapping. It's been a long time coming, Josh. Basically an entire season to the episode since this has happened. Let's see the two chat it out here.
Charlie told me it was your idea to kidnap me.
You gonna tell Jen?
No.
Why not?
Because then we'd have to dig another grave.
Why you give me these?
Because they're worthless here.
See, and I thought I was going to get out of this without a lesson.
This is a badass sun scene.
Very good sun scene.
I would honestly say the most badass sun scene until we get There's No Place Like Home, where she flat out like calls Charles Winmore to his face.
Yeah, that's pretty cold-blooded as well. I love it. I love it. I love Sun being like, no, I know how to keep secrets from Jin.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing as well.
And you can imagine that that's one reason why she does forgive Sawyer from a certain perspective is because she, like, much like Locke with Paolo, she knows firsthand what it's like to keep a secret that can change everything. But also a great, like, you know, sort of chest pump on Sun's part to be like, no, I wouldn't tell Jin because, yeah, he was basically in, like, the mob under my father, and he would probably kill you if he found out.
He'd probably murder you, and I don't want another death. We're all tired from digging these.
Yeah, let me tell you about the day he came home with blood on his hands.
Yeah. So I love this scene from Sun. She nearly got an MVP point from me this week.
I know. I was very close to giving her one as well. But
there's just a lot of candidates to give MVP points, and the two really obvious ones to give the LVPs to. So I love this moment. I think it's very in character. Sun does not always tell Jin everything, especially if she thinks it's going to hurt him or somebody else. And for the greater good here, she's like, I'm making the judgment call that I'm letting this go, but also F you, dude.
Well, also, it wouldn't be Jin's call. Like, at the end of the day, it should be Sun as the one who makes the decision, much like sort of the whole Amira thing from Enter 7-7, right? Like, the stuff was done to her. She should be the last person to decide it. And I do think that her making the decision, again, is couched in a lot of her own path, but also hopefully means, as we talked about, that's sort of like the more deplorable stuff that Charlie and Sawyer did, particularly in seasons 1 and 2, are sort of behind us now. We are turning the page, as you spoke about with your metaphors before, for a lot of these characters, and that sort of shows with Sawyer here.
And so this is what's going to get us into the end game, pretty much.
Yeah, and so it's going to get into Nikki and Paolo's end game for sure, as Hurley gives a eulogy here. It's been a little while, right? We had the Anna Lucia and Libby funeral was the last time there were speeches given. Obviously, again, in a fun little lampshade moment, Hurley, not much to say about Nikki and Paolo. They said good stuff to him. They were members of the camp, and Hurley loves expose. Those are the three
really
things.
Yeah, loves expose.
And the three talking points.
But, you know, Hurley's great in this episode of, like, being sort of the glue that keeps everyone together, right? Like, I think, like, being, you know, once again, this week and next week, there are these underlying stories of Hurley as the leader of this group. Even though, like, the story next week will literally be about Hurley trying to convince Sawyer that he's the leader of this group. And I think, like, that's a leadership move. So I love President Reyes in this episode, you know. I love what Hugo is doing. And the fact that he finds himself in the eulogy spot here, I think, tells you everything you need to know about how Lost was planning that in the end, like, the happy ending is to, like, leave this very important place in the hands of a gentle king.
So that's going to take us into the last moments we see Nikki and Paolo at least walking. So Nikki leads Paolo out into the middle of the jungle.
She's
and
like, hey, Paolo. And he's like, what? Like, Paolo. Yeah.
Paolo.
Nikki.
<Sorry.
laughs> Yeah. So this is when she Medusa spiders him. And she aggressively throws the spider onto him.
Right. So here's the thing. So Nikki leads Paolo and says, like, I found the diamonds, Paolo. And he goes, oh, really? And she says, yeah, they're on you right now. Where are they? And before he even, like, is able to stammer out an answer, she uncorks the Medusa spider, throws it onto him, and then just gives a very menacing expo dump about how, oh, the Medusa spider actually comes from the fact that if it bites you, you become paralyzed or paralyzed for around 8 hours. And so essentially, Nikki sort of monologues here, syndrome style, where she talks about, like, oh, yeah, you thought you could get away with this. I'm going to do so much bad stuff to you. I don't know what that means, either of a sexual variety or not, but it's still a little menacing. When Nikki forgets, and Dr. Arce told her, even through his love goggles, is that the Medusa spider's pheromones attract many other males of the species from all around congregating onto it like seagulls on a hot dog bun. And so, as Paolo, you know, tears are streaming down his face, I think he is very sincere. He's not an actor like Nikki. I do think he is very sincere about, like, listen, the only
Unless
reason
he's
why
wearing a chef's coat, that's the only
yeah
thing.
The only reason why I did this is maybe part of greed, but also because like I wanted to get it out of sight, out of mind, because I was afraid what would happen with your greed. But Nikki is not having it. He says, "I'm sorry." She says, "I'm only sorry. You're only sorry because you got caught." And spiders encroach on Nikki. And Josh, we hear a familiar rattle here.
We do. We hear the hum of the smoke monster. And on the official Lost podcast in March 21, 2008. Damon Lindelof confirms that these spiders are indeed the monster, which makes me wonder a little bit, like, how did the effects of the Medusa spider translate then? Unless, like, the smoke monster was, like, the Pied Piper, and, yeah, like, exactly. Pied Piper to a shit ton of Medusa spiders to Nikki, and one of them bites her. Maybe it's that. I don't know. Like, maybe, like, at least one errant Medusa spider sees a bunch of smoke monster Medusa spiders, like, yeah, I'm going with that. But then it also, like, you imagine... Because the smoke monster rules, as we understand them, is the smoke monster takes on the likeness of someone dead on the island. So does that mean that there is just like a dead nest of Medusa spiders somewhere that the monster is imitating at this moment in time?
I don't know. But I don't know. We talked about like the boar, right, from Outlaws. I think the difference mm-hmm. between like the boar and the horse and this is that the boar and the horse did not injure or impact the A15ers that were chasing after them. This spider... Or at least maybe it was taking the form of one spider. Maybe it was taking the form of like the lead spider and then let one of the other spiders actually bite Nikki. Because I can't imagine that it would actually cause paralysis in
her. I think Smokey here is of a couple of minds of like, one is like, Nikki and Paolo suck. These guys are idiots. These guys suck and they don't deserve to live.
So this is more of a mercy kill of like, it's well, like I can have them in here and like sow distrust within the group, but like, let's just get rid of them.
Well, it's a mercy killing, I guess, to some extent, but it's also like an agonizing way for these two people to die. And I think for the smoke monster, if the smoke monster's involved, it's like, let's see what these guys do with two bodies that they think are BODYS but are actually still alive. Mm-hmm. Let's Michael Jackson popcorn thriller gif and see how this all shakes out. And so, if the smoke monster is all about chaos, this is definitely a win for chaos.
Yeah, plus it might cause some more, you know, if it knows about, like, the walkie-talkie, for instance, I don't know how much intel it has on the camp, like, it definitely caused a ruckus for an afternoon, right? Where, like, they couldn't trust them, and then nobody trusted Sawyer, and it was just a big to-do. Speaking of Sawyer, so we see now what happens. Nikki gets bit, and her paralysis does not take as much effect as Paolo, because Paolo got straight in the jugular. Nikki at least gets bit on the ankle, so she has some time to run out to the clearing, say very clearly now what we know is paralyzed before becoming such, but 815 does not know that. And we get what I still believe, I will hammer home what I said last week, this is the darkest ending in Lost history, as Hurley and Sawyer unintentionally bury Nikki alive as her eyes open in the very last shot. It's some very haunting music from Giacchino that I'm going to play in the outro for this podcast, because it's just so menacing and gruesome and dark as hell.
It's dark, but it's very, very funny.
Dark things can be funny, though.
You know, I think, like, it's the darkest ending. I don't know that I agree. I think that there's... certainly, I think that the darkest ending of this is also something that's very linked to this episode. And what I would say is that this ending is one of two endings on Lost that stand out to me as like heavily Stephen King inspired. Like, Exposé feels like a short Stephen King story. And Uncle Steve writes his stories that are often filled with grim contents in ways that are often comedic, that are ridiculous, that are absurdist. And all of that quality is here, like very dark comedy type of ending to this story that like the irony is they were not dead the whole time. And that now by eulogizing and burying them, you're the ones who are killing them and you'll never know it. And the audience will be the only ones who ever know it. That is super Stephen King. A version of a Stephen King type of ending to me that happens much later in Lost that I think is linked through that same mechanism, but is not funny and is actually just dark and cruel irony, and to me is the darkest ending in all of Lost, pretty much without peer, is Daniel Faraday getting killed by his own mom in The Variable. That is dark. That isn't funny. That's ironic that his life was all building towards this moment, and it was inevitably building towards this moment where he finally thinks that he's cracked science, but he's wrong. He's just fulfilling his grim destiny. That is so much bleaker. This is played for laughs. This is played for laughs.
Right, but I'm not saying...
You're supposed to walk away from expose thinking that it's ridiculous and funny that Hurley and Sawyer have done this.
But we have to take the absolute value. Again, let me give you a... Josh, would you rather be shot or buried alive, suffocating slowly to death?
Yeah, but I don't think that defines the choice. I think
it defines the choice, personally.
I think the tone defines the choice. I think the tone defines the choice. I think the tone of what's happening, and also, like... Sure, being buried alive is absolutely awful compared to the way that Daniel goes, which is also really bad. But Daniel's entire life is effectively being buried alive. His entire life is being pushed onto a track to get him to the moment where he gets killed by his own mom. Very knowingly by his mom, knowing from the moment he is born that this is where he will end up. That is extraordinarily dark. His entire life that's filled with pain and choices that are not his because he's being pushed on this path of inevitability. That is tremendously horrible.
So I mean, tremendously horrible.
It is not even close.
I completely disagree. It's not as horrible as two beloved characters getting blood on their hands by burying two. Just because you get a chuckle out of it, that means that
it's
not... 100%. It's completely disagree. It's not about the tone. It's not about the tone whatsoever.
I would love to get people to weigh in. Which do you think is the darker ending, expose or the variable? Down the hatch at PoetryRecaps.com. We are in hard disagreement over this one.
We're in hard disagreement, which is we're in agreement about most of this episode. But I mean, like, it's not even close for me. It's not even close.
It's dark, but it's funny. It's funny. It's played for laughs. It's a joke. The whole thing is a Shaggy Dog story for this moment, which is a gas. It's a gas. It's ridiculous. It is another commentary of like, yeah, we're gonna bury these characters, but they were alive once, and they are alive as they're being buried alive. And it's also supposed to, I think, make you feel kind of bad for like wishing death upon Nikki and Powell. It's like, all right, well, careful what you wish for. We're burying them alive, and your favorite characters are doing it, and you're like, ugh, I feel icky.
Yeah, this ending really reminds me. And again, take the comedic elements out of it almost, like it is a very much like a Black Mirror Twilight Zone ending, right? Because
exactly.
it is about the irony, yes, of like of all the things. It actually reminds me of God, what was it? Hayden in the Nation, I think, is the Black Mirror episode where, spoiler alert, basically people were using hashtags to be like, kill so-and-so, and a serial killer was using a bunch of robotic bees, not spiders, to kill those people. So it was like, look, the blood is on your hands for wishing death upon them. And this is kind of the message, like you said, it's very cathartic on behalf of the Lost writers to shrug off these characters, have them shrug off their mortal coil. But it's also a way to sort of point it back on the viewers of like, well, you wanted us to get rid of Nikki and Paolo.
Well,
this is how we did it.
This is how we're going
to
do it. Yeah, I think it's messed up. It's absolutely messed up. But when you say like, man, that's messed up, you say it with this tone of voice. When you think about what happens to like a Daniel Faraday, you're like, man, that sucks. Because you care about the character. You don't care about Nikki and Paolo, but it does make you reflect on your own bloodlust,
what the Nikki and Paolo thing does. I'll kind of admit, and this speaks to my own proclivities, I kind of had the expose-like reaction to the end of the variable.
Okay, interesting. I think like there's definitely ways in which like in the way that like I can at least laugh in the face of extraordinary adversity, because how else am I going to survive that moment? That I can find myself laughing about aspects of the variable for sure. But I think that the tone, it's decisively meant to make you feel awful. Whereas like, the tone of this maybe is designed to make you feel awful, but also as a joke, also as
right.
a lark.
Well, I think as someone who has made his way through a lot of dark comedy, I think there is certainly room to do awful things, but still with a comedic tone to it.
All right. Well, weigh in on the great debate, which is the bleaker ending, expose or the variable. I think it's a great debate. I love it.
Yeah.
Let's get into some feedback. We got a lot of feedback for this one. There's tons to get through. One, this is from the Ben Behind the Curtain, that apparently the writer of Exposé is a character named Rick Lapidus.
Oh, what?
Rick Lapidus. Apparently Eddie Kitsis is obsessed with the name Lapidus.
I mean, Frank Lapidus, I mean, not only is it going to be like an MVP character coming up, but like a pretty MVP name as well.
A great name. I guess Rick Lapidus is one of the actors on Exposé, on one of the script pages you see. So it leaves us to wonder what's his connection to Frank. So Rick Lapidus gets on the show, and then as they were coming up with the idea of Frank as a character, Edward Kitsis insisted on the name Frank Lapidus. So not only is Frank Lapidus connected to Seth Norris, the pilot of 815,
yeah,
but is also connected to the world of Exposé. Like, you can imagine, Mike, the world in which, to get some side cash, Frank Lapidus is moonlighting as Rick Lapidus, as like a background player. I mean, he's very chesty Burt Reynolds, right?
Or it could be a thing where he was going to be like, all right, I'm going to fly to Sydney, typical route, going to visit my brother on the set of Exposé, and then I'll fly right back. You know, typical turnaround. And just because he ended up not going in that day, his life changed.
Yeah. All right, so is Exposé good or bad? We've got some people commenting on this. The great Trevor Roberts writes in, I remember hating this episode when it first aired. It felt like masturbatory writing, oddly set up, and a genuine filler episode. But on the rewatch, I want a bitch slap 2007, Trev.
I love Sun and Sawyer.
Yeah, because I freaking love it. The weaving in of two characters through the story's full arc thus far in a bizarre This Is How We Do a Clip Show on Lost, only to kill them. It's delicious, calculated, and smart as balls. Brian Edwards writes in, Exposé. For me, this is the episode that makes me mad at the viewers. Specifically, the viewers who refused to give Nikki and Paolo a chance. They could have been so good had fans not so narrow-mindedly rejected them. Had the original plan happened, we would have had an incredible storyline, and the events of this episode would have played out over several episodes, with the Exposé flashback fake-out playing over a whole episode, only to be revealed at the end. Would have been so fun to watch, but this is still a fantastic episode. Funny, twisted, and with the absolute best jaw-dropper of an ending. It still gets me every single time. The great Brendan Fitzpatrick weighs in and says, I think my favorite part of Exposé is that it gives us more Ethan and even Arst at Jack's Live Together, Die Alone speech. It's like a special FU from Damon and Carlton of, you believe these two people were there the whole time, but in Ethan and Arst, but not Nikki and Paolo.
Trevor brings up a good point in particular. Like, would you consider this, I don't think it's clip show, but like clip show-esque in what it's going for?
I think that there's an element of that. Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think like in terms of like show within a show, there is an element of just like resetting and reminding you of who certain characters were and certain milestone events.
Which is different from the speech
being very specifically central to the core themes of the show.
Right, which we should say is different from the other 48 days, which was, with the exception of Boone over the radio saying what he didn't say the first time, distinctly different from everything else going on the other side of the island.
In terms of bad, this is from, I'll just identify as Scott, not Steve, who gave the episode a flat zero and was, you know, very, very kind about it in the feedback email. So I do not mean to drag Scott/Steve. Who gave the episode flat zero, but want to give Scott's articulation over why this episode gets a zero. Scott says, over the preceding weeks, I have listened to a lot of discussion about what the worst episode in Lost history is. A lot of candidates have been mentioned, but none of them are the correct answer. Ever since I watched Exposé the first time, I've wondered why there isn't a complete consensus about this episode as the worst in Lost history. Let's start with the fact that the very existence of Nikki and Paolo, Oceanic 815, fuselage section survivors who have been there the whole time but we never noticed until now, is ridiculous on its face. Yes, the show realized this and got rid of them quickly, but instead of quietly writing them back into oblivion or having them killed off suddenly as part of some other story, something I think we all could have celebrated, we get this convoluted episode that weaves them into earlier events of the show. Does anyone really believe Nikki and Paolo found the Pearl Station or the Beechcraft before anyone else and then kept it to themselves? They have a backstory that no one needed, a ridiculous buried alive plot, and ultimately a complete waste of an episode of Lost. This episode exists solely to rid us of something that should never have happened in the first place. It's throwing good money after bad.
It's a really interesting point. But I think what Scott is trying to argue here, I mean, first, I think he's trying to do a little bit of like whatever happened, right? Of like, well, the issue with this episode is that Nikki and Paolo existed in the first place, which is like, yes, obviously the ideal decision would have been not having these characters appear in the first place.
I don't think there's any disagreement on that.
Yeah, but the issue is that they can't do that. They haven't gotten to the time travel season yet where they talk about those elements. So how do you do it? And I love the audacity. I mean, season three has brought a lot of audacious storytelling elements into Lost. And I think the audacity of being able to do this, and in my opinion, pull off what they were going for, I think should be commended here. I think so much of it is tongue in cheek that it's practically poking through the side of the face at this point in terms of them knowing like exactly what they're doing. No, nobody's supposed to believe that they were there the entire time. That's the point. That's what we're going for here. We're making a reference to it. It's meta. And I guess the other thing is that, I mean, it's tough to say, Josh, would you think, does Lost ever really get as meta as it does after Exposé here?
No, not quite like this. Certainly not. The other thing I'll add to that is there are times where the show, like kills a character for a gag. And with Arst, it works because like the character was set up specifically to be killed off like a gag. I think the same with like Froger, right? Yeah. Like I think these are characters who like they build knowing that they will just be red shirts that like have like glorious red shirt deaths. But there's a very good example of a character who's not working for whatever reasons, and we've got a lot of time before we have to start unpacking it, but a character who's not working, who is a series regular, who they give the literal Arse treatment to, and that's Ilana. And the fact that they just literally blow her up in the middle of a speech after she's like seemingly here for important reasons, but she's not working or clicking or connecting as a character anymore, so they just need to write her off because they've made this mistake. That feels like you don't dwell on it too much, but it feels very unsatisfying, and that makes you feel like, well, what was the whole point of Ilana in the first place? Whereas right. at least with Nikki and Paolo, who are, again, series regulars, these aren't just random guest stars that they put on the show. They were characters that they wanted to do a thing with, and quickly realized that this was a mistake, and we started doing the thing with these characters, and it's not working, and we need to figure out a way to do it, that they've already like invested enough press and literal money into these characters.
Right, so essentially, to use a West Wing aphorism, if they sent these two to Mandyville, I do not think it would be proper Lost, you know?
They're already at this point where they've, you know, it's throwing good money after bad, but Lost has to, like, it, and it's known, it's part of the thing, right, that in season three, Lost is like trying to figure out how to like survive and like tread water because they're not being allowed to end the show yet. And so they have these huge seasons of 20 plus episodes. And you know, there's a reason why when they start to end the show that the design is for each season to be shorter. And I think, you know, they probably feel like, well, it's not going to work with Nikki and Paolo. We've invested some story energy into the ideas behind them. Let's just do a send up. Let's just like have a good time and like have a blast with this and you know, have some fun with the audience. And for some people it works, and then for some people it doesn't. And like, if you can't just get past the argument of they should never have existed in the first place, so they shouldn't have had an episode of their own, that's, you know, that's going to be tough to get past. But I think if you give the episode a shot on its own merit, there are great jokes in here. There are some legitimate great scenes. The John Locke scene is great. Like, there's just like, even without comedy, like there's some great scenes in here. But the comedy for me is just top notch. And the meta-ness and like taking a moment to pause and breathe and acknowledge the ways in which, like, we know you love this show, but trust us, we make the show. This is an imperfect show. And we're going to talk to you about it. And we're going to talk to you about it through Exposé. We're going to expose the ways in which we have messed up.
As Charlie says, an expose when he first reads the title of the script.
You know, so I hear the arguments that this episode shouldn't exist. I disagree with them about as voraciously as I disagree with our stances on the ending of this versus The Variable. I would say even harder. I think Exposé is a delight. I think Exposé should absolutely exist, and I'm thrilled that it does. A favorite episode of television.
Let's answer a what if here. Daniel Brennan asked, do you guys think it would have been possible for the writers to create Oceanic 815 passengers who we did not see until the beginning of season three that the audience actually was invested in?
No,
so you think it was like a sunk cost here that like it was a failed experiment to begin with?
I don't think that they could have, other than designing them like Arst, like Froger, literally like characters that are designed for like a couple of moments and then are, you know, there to basically like...
Yeah, not occurring in a recurring basis for like, I think they made what, like probably four appearances between the two of them before this episode.
They are literal contracted series regulars. They are they are being paid and billed as if they are main cast. They are main cast. Rodrigo Santoro and Keely Sanchez are main cast members. They're not guest stars. They are main cast members. that is very different from what they're doing with Daniel Roebuck as Leslie Aurst and William Apather. Yeah, like those are characters who are designed to be able to float in and out of the narrative. They are setting up characters here with Nikki and Paolo to exist on the show in meaningful ways out of absolutely nowhere. I don't think that there was a way that ever was going to work with anybody unless the character was like a real lights out character. But who do you need in that regard? Who shows up in that realm? Certainly not someone of the Nikki and Paolo mode who, as you've noted, really are just like Diet, Boone, and Shannon.
Yeah. They didn't want to be like them, and they did. Let's take actually the other side of the things. Stephan Johnson talks about maybe even taking a bigger risk with these characters. Do you think this episode would have worked if this was the only time we ever saw Nikki and Paolo? So it's actually very similar to the episode Lower Decks that I mentioned before from Star Trek TNG. If Nikki and Paolo had not appeared on the show previously, and we just dedicate an episode to these two characters who have never been seen before and will never be seen again, is that too big of a risk for you?
I don't think that it makes sense to do. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know why you bother with this episode. I don't think this episode exists unless they made the mistake that they made. I don't see it. Like, I don't see them doing like the Dr. Arst episode. You know, like I don't see the world where Born to Run or Exodus was, you know, a Dr. Arst flashback. I mean, I guess with Exodus they could have had a flashback segment that was about Dr. Arst.
Yeah, it could have been like the Hurley montage instead of Arst going to the airport.
You know, or they could have had that in addition somewhere. Yeah. But no, I don't think that it makes sense to do this unless like they've already screwed up. So yeah, Exodus can only exist if a tragic error has already
been made. That's the thing, is that there's so much catharsis baked into the DNA of this episode that to have it, like, I feel like, honestly, it expose with Nikki and Paolo as one-off characters honestly feels like something that you would see on like Community or Rick and Morty. That feels like very up Dan Harmon's alley, and that feels a little too meta for my taste, especially like, yes, we are past the halfway point of Lost, but we're also only just past the halfway point of Lost. Like, you can certainly take risks with the show, but I think that would be, in my opinion, a little bit too much.
It just wouldn't make sense.
And if it would fail on the point that, like, you need to have a history with these characters.
So Derek, during the live watch, the great Derek Blaze had written in during the live watch and said, would Nikki have had time to save herself if she didn't bury the diamonds first? She has an extra 30 seconds to talk at the beach.
I do wonder if her vocal abilities... Well, I don't know, because Paolo seemed to be able to... His body went first, and he was able to talk very cogently. I imagine that it might just be 30 more seconds of Nikki babbling complete nonsense and nobody being able to understand what she's saying.
Yeah, I think it feels to me like if she hadn't buried the diamonds... Because I don't know that it's just 30 seconds, you know?
She had to run two minutes to the clock. Yeah, she's not Kate. She can't run in, like, she can't be the Flash here.
Yeah. I feel like if she gives up the diamonds, or if she just holds on to them, puts it in her pocket.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Look, Paolo did it. Why not you?
And then
Or throw it into the jungle.
Okay, and so she puts the diamonds in her pocket. She runs back to the beach. She lands in front of the ping pong table, goes, guys, I am about to pass out. I got bitten by a Medusa spider. I don't know if you ever talked to Dr. Arst about the Medusa spiders, but they bite you and you're paralyzed and it looks like you're dead, but you're not. Also, Paolo's in the jungle. Same thing happened to him. I'm about to go out. Peace. And then she drops. And then they're like, oh, okay. Well, that's a lot. All right. We will do our best to keep you shaded and hydrated rather than like dry and toasting in the sun or, like you said, asphyxiating under a blanket and then ultimately being buried alive. And then if they searched the body at one point, that would be weird and creepy because she's just said she's alive. So that's one thing. But if they do that, and then Nikki comes back. They're like, hey, what's up with these diamonds? Nikki can retort, hey, what's up with you touching my body while I have no control over my body?
Yeah, I was the one that was going to torture Paolo, not you.
And B, you've never asked me what I do. And what I do is I work on TV and expose. And this was a glamorous thing that I bought in Australia that I was bringing home for myself. And those are my diamonds. And you could be a severe dick right now and not give them back. But do you really want to be that person? So I feel like Nikki probably should have pocketed the diamonds and just run back to the beach and she'd still be alive.
Here's the thing. does Nikki tell them about Paolo? You know, like, because did you think that she might actually have the capacity to, like, let Paolo die while she survives?
She never meant him to die, right? Like, that was never part of the plan.
No, she just wanted to, quote unquote, have fun with him for those 8 hours.
Yeah. Like, she never wanted him to die. And also, it wouldn't make sense within the story that she's just told, I think. Like, I think, like, if she's telling them, like, I'm about to be paralyzed, they'll find Paolo, and at the very least, they'll see him and be like, oh, is he paralyzed too? Maybe we should wait.
Yeah. Though at this point, if the two of them end up coming clean with the story, maybe they're going to be the ones instead of Sawyer up for banishment in the next episode.
Brenna did write in and said, where do you rate the way that Nikki and Paolo die as far as a way to die? Mike, this is where I will agree. This is a horrible way to go.
Oh, yeah. This is by far
the worst way to die. This is a horrible way to go.
Because I'm trying to think about, like, you could say, like, oh, you know, getting exploded, like, I would say Boone probably had a pretty terrible way to die considering how slow and prolonged it was to the point where they were going to cut off his leg.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I think, of everyone who died, I think the ones who got exploded by far had the best way to do it. Like, your Michaels, your Saeeds, your Jinin sons are pretty bad up there, too. I don't know. Maybe it's just because of my fear of open water, but I do not like drowning.
This
Poor
is
Joanna.
Bad, this is definitely bad. This is definitely a bad one. Ben Martell says, did Mr. Echo have a premonition about this episode? Echo did say, you're next. And Nikki and Paolo were the next victims of the monster. So did Echo call the shot, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't ask the monster, told him, like, I'm going to disguise myself as a spider and tell all the other spiders to bite Nikki and Paolo so they think they're paralyzed and then bury them alive.
Yeah, I think that could be it. That could be it.
Wow, Echo. Well, screw Desmond. Echo has the true superpower then.
Final one from Stefan Johnson. Would you guys watch Exposé, the TV show, and then podcast about it? Hells yeah.
Yeah, though I think
Razzle Dazzle.
I think it would be more of like a Robin Akiva Nita podcast. Like, I do think that Exposé seems like the perfect season 3, episode 7, like, what the hell is this show type of slice of life. I don't know how tired we would get of talking about the adventures of Crystal and Autumn every week, depending on what they're doing.
Such disrespect for a show that took 4 seasons to build up to the Cobra reveal, Mike. You know, it's clearly got a very meticulously planned arc.
Well, yeah, let's ask about that. Do you think that the writers of Exposé and director Stephen Williams, did they plan the Cobra reveal from the very beginning, or did they leave it open-ended, building the plane as they flew and said, like, okay, I guess, Mr. Lashad's the Cobra?
It was part of the plan the whole time. They knew everything the whole way through. What's the report from the Jim Fells music analysis beat?
So there is a, you know, an expose theme that Giacchino creates called Sweet Expose. And actually, there was a
Sweet
video podcast.
Sweet Expose.
Ba-ba buried. So there's actually a video podcast, because in addition to the Damon and Carlton podcast, back in the days of like the popularized iPod video, they would release video podcasts. And I believe from this week, they actually went behind the scenes with Giacchino when it came to scoring this episode. But the expose theme is only going to play one more time in the series. And it actually plays in probably one of the most real life expose moments in the show's history, which is in the beginning of the end when Hurley is driving the car being chased by the cops.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it makes sense, right? It's like you hear like the bongos. Like, it definitely seems out of like one of those 70s cop shows of him trying to drive through fruit stands.
Yeah. I would love to have seen Hurley buy his way into Exposé. That should have been something he did with his money.
Yeah, he's like, in memory of Howard Zuckerman, I'm planning a reboot of Exposé.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. That'd be great. All right, let's do some points. Let's do some rankings. I think that the MVP points, this is where it gets a little harder. I think
there's a lot to give out here.
The LVPs, I think, are pretty straightforward. So we could start there. You know, Nikki and Paolo are getting everything.
Right. So it's going to be ultimately 3 to Nikki, 2 to Paolo.
Well, my question to you on this, Mike, is could we just give Nikki and Paolo the points on all of the categories, and so they get a half point each? I don't know how it adds up.
Well, because then what would happen is, I don't think Nikki got any LVP points up to this point.
So Nikki gets 3 LVP points here, 2 from you, 1 from me. Paolo gets 2, 1 from me, 1 from you, and Paolo had an existing one, at least one existing one.
I think he had 2, because there was some jerkish stuff they did, and I believe we gave 2 actually for the whole takes a shit thing with the cost of living.
So Nikki ends at -3 and Paulo ends at -4. So I know that there were people who had been worried, looking at you, Stefan, that we were going to end this thing without Nikki and Paulo landing in the red. Of course they were going to land in the red. And yeah, even just, if like their existence means that an episode like Exposé can exist and is an episode that's well worth celebrating, I still feel like, they're still pieces of shit.
Well, so to answer Stefan's question, it honestly comes down to visibility. Like, we pointed this out. I think in retrospect, while Nikki and Paulo are remembered as a stain upon Lost, they're actually rather innocuous until this episode. Like, they've appeared in drips and drabs. I think the cost of living might honestly be, like, the most we see them. Whereas Boone and Shannon were so front and center during some really aggravating moments, especially in season one, between, you know, Shannon's constant complaining, between I run a business. Like, there were some real jerkish moments from Boone and Shannon that were much more in the spotlight than Nikki and Paulo. So right. It was more rife for the LVPs. I would say, like, it does feel wrong a little bit for Paulo to be below Nikki, just because I do feel like Nikki was way worse in this episode than Paulo, but Paulo proved himself worse on Island, I suppose. So I guess, and they're close to each other enough. So
yeah,
I guess it bounces
fine.
Out.
They're a 3 and a 4. It works out. They're terrible. They're dead. They died horribly. They died so that Exposé could live. It's a trade that I will take. Let's get into the MVPs. This is a little bit harder to do because I think there's a lot of people who are great in this episode. And even though he doesn't do much, I just feel like, to start things off, how do we not give an MVP point to Billy Dee Williams?
Like, how do the we walk real from, life actor Billy Dee
how
Williams.
How do we walk away from an episode where Billy Dee Williams shows up as Billy Dee Williams, Lando Calrissian himself, and not give him an MVP point? So I just feel like that has to happen. Like, I feel like In the same way that Nikki and Paulo have to swallow up all the LVPs, I think Billy Dee Williams requires his presence necessitates an MVP point.
Plus, you gotta commend him. He's doing great cover-up for being the Cobra, right? Like, he immediately foists the blame onto poor Corvette after he kills her. Like, he's been undercover for 4 seasons at this point, and it looks like it's going. For my first MVP point, it's a little mixed. He's not completely in the positive, but I gotta give a point to Sawyer here, because he figures a lot of stuff out. You know, he goes off on his own because he's the one who figured out the dirt under the fingernails. And I think this is, again, a nice key clue as to where Sawyer is going to end up in another universe. And he does do the right thing in sort of just dumping away the worthless diamonds in the end. And he really doesn't cause that much harm other than some suspicion. So I think this is actually a fairly impressive episode for Sawyer.
So I'll give a shout out to Derek Blaze, who watched this episode with me in the Discord. For my MVP point, my next two MVP points, in fact, are as decided on the watch that we did in the Discord. Hurley gets my first, and that's Derek, who really put the argument forward of like, this is a great episode of Hurley the Leader. He's trying to get the band together. He's trying to really solve this thing. He really cares about what's happened here. He knows about Exposé. He's just like showing all of his strengths on his sleeve. He's empathetic here. He's curious. I think that it's a great Hurley episode for sure. So I think Hurley deserves an MVP point here.
I'm torn here, Josh. Try to convince me one way or the other. I have one more MVP point. Do I give it to Arst or do I give it to Sun?
It's really up to you. Sun has an... I'm not giving Sun the point because I have a pick that... So I'll go first.
You go first. Let's leave like the actual nail biter.
Sure,
to me at the
sure.
End here.
So Charlie is getting an MVP point for coming clean to Sun.
Coming clean,
and taking the moment to like air that dirty laundry and say like, Sun, remember in season 2 when you got kidnapped by the others? It wasn't them. It was me. It was a stupid thing.
It wasn't them.
It wasn't them. I did this. I did it. It was me. And as I was watching the episode with a group of about 15 other people, there was a lot of campaigning for Charlie to get an MVP point for being self-aware, for volunteering this information, for owning up to what he did, and also a lot of people being very concerned that when we're at the end of this whole thing, Charlie's going to be in the red.
So this is what sort of like us, preparing ourselves, sort of like, preparing the runway for that Charlie plane to hopefully take off.
So I already knew Billy Dee Williams was going to get a point. Derek had convinced me at this point that Hurley deserves a point. So then the question for me was, Should it be Charlie? Should it be Sun? Or should it be the smoke monster for killing Nikki and Paolo? And I put it up to an official poll. We created a poll.
And it's going to do democracy.
We did democracy. And by we had Sun, Charlie, and the monster. Those were the three options in order. And it was a 2-9-2 vote, overwhelmingly in favor of Charlie. So okay. I counted the votes. They revealed the answer. Charlie wins. I think I probably would have given it to Sun. Arst wasn't really on my radar. The other person that I'd consider giving an MVP point if we had the room for it is Vincent for trying to save the lives of these two people who were not dead. Once again, Vincent, who's just not really showing up, this really good boy, who's just really not showing up much in the MVP, LVP category. I would have given it to Sun if not for the vote for Charlie.
Yeah, it's tough because I just really love seeing Daniel Roebuck here. Like, it is peak Arst of him being an a-hole and belligerent and besides himself. We didn't mention the Animal Farm reference as he walked up and down the speech being like, the pigs are walking upright. But I feel like sort of, I guess, following your lead, if you give a point to Charlie for apologizing to Sun, I have to sort of in turn give a point to Sun for forgiving Sawyer, right? It would feel weird to acknowledge the Charlie point and not acknowledge the Sun point for what she did. Granted, she may have her own reasons to do that, but like it's a Charlie. I think like Charlie and Sun together sort of like tag team the burying of that plot point from the long con. And so I feel like let's tag team this pairing as well, that Sun got a slap in as well. And it was a badass scene. So I guess Sun's great character moments unfortunately outweigh the comedy value that was Dr. Arst here. And so I'm going to give the point to Sun. I'm going to give a honor the Quan in this episode.
I think it's the right call. I think it's the right call. I think Sun over Arst makes sense to me. So those are your MVP.
And it also means that now Sun has as many points as Jin does in for season three. They both are out now at 1.5 each.
All right. That's great. All right, so MVP, LVPs are settled. Let's do the 4.2 stars. I said it last week that Exposé is getting a 4.2. I am not wavering. I'm giving Exposé a perfect score. I will acknowledge that, like, sort of in the same way that, like, Trisha Tanaka is an avatar of an idea, right? Like, Trisha Tanaka is an avatar for me of, like, the levity of Lost and, like, the hangout quality of Lost. And that, like, to say that spinning your wheels is a marker of poor quality, I disagree. I think sometimes you can spin your wheels and have just a total blast doing it. I think Exposé, much like Annie's pen, Mike, is not a pen, it's a principle.
Wow, look at you with the reference.
How about that? Good, right?
Yeah, so does this mean that at the end actually a monkey comes in and unburies Nikki and Paolo?
Well, the monkey taking the pen is sort of early burying Nikki and Paolo alive. You didn't see that one coming. So I give Exposé a 4.2, and that score is further calloused in 4.2 territory, entrenched in 4.2 territory, not just because of personal taste, but also because there are the ones and zeros of the world from certain parties that I think aren't really giving the episode a proper chance and aren't giving it a proper a fair shake. Because I think if you were to give Exposé a fair shake, I cannot imagine how you land anywhere near a zero or a one, personally. But to each their own. I know you won't be nearly as high. You've got your grading rubric, but that's partly to explain the 4.2. It's a counterbalance measure. Make sure Exposé is at least not as, you know, Exposé is probably going to end up being like fairly mid-tier in our overall rankings,
right?
would be my guess.
True to its polarizing nature, it lands somewhere right in the middle.
And I think that is totally fair for like a community ranking. But for like my personal set of episodes of Lost that I love, Exposé is right near the top of the list. And is one of those episodes, much like Trisha Tanaka, I could just throw this episode on at any given time and I will have a great time with it.
Yeah, which is, you know, very pertinent considering, you know, when this is coming out and people are looking for perhaps a lark. So that being said, yeah, I'm not as high. I definitely have some great feelings towards the episode. Like you said, like it is audacious. I feel like it's pulled off and it warms like my nostalgic heart to see moments and characters from season one brought back, even if, you know, it's like season one Boone and Shannon and they're not exactly the most delightful characters. A lot of comparisons are drawn to Trisha Tanaka, which I gave a 3.8. And I like Trisha Tanaka more as an episode than Expose. I feel like Trisha Tanaka does so much more with a lot of character stuff between Hurley, between Charlie, between Sawyer. Those are really like the big three character arcs that exist through Trisha Tanaka that make it such a great episode. I know that's not the intention of Expose, but the fact that it's missing from there definitely takes it down a couple pegs, coupled with I'm still not a fan. And that's what I will agree with our goose egg giver here about how I do not think the whole finding of the pearl is really it's not something that I personally like in the episode, even though I do understand the tongue in cheek nature of it all. So I only went slightly below. I gave it a 3.6. And it looks like, you know, like you said, we've got a 0 and a 1. I see a couple of low 2s, but I think for the most part, we pretty much have skewed mid threes to a number of 4.2s. It's going to lead to a 3.3 overall from the listeners. And so with your 4.2, with my 3.6, with the audience's 3.3, that gives an average score of 3.704 Expose, which puts it, we're in 14 episodes. Josh, it is right in the middle at number 7, slightly above Enter 7-7, which now leaves being number 7, and right below Not in Portland at 3.76.
Yeah. And whatever. You know, I think for it to be where it's landed, I don't agree with it, but I get it. It makes sense. It's a divisive episode. There are people who are going to be very low on it, people who are going to be very high on it. I think like the high highs, you could certainly make the argument that you people are crazy, just in the same way that I'm saying like the zeros are insane to me. So it is the most polarizing episode of Lost. And that includes the one with the polar bear cages.
Exactly.
And I love it. And I love it so much. And I will treasure this episode forever. It's a real road marker for me, Mike, that we have made it to this point in the podcast that we've talked through Expose. You know, we're at this place where there's just a lot of mile markers that are happening right now on Lost. I gotta say, next week, not really one of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I don't think Expose is in danger of falling under number 7, because next week is Left Behind, which, you know what, you talked about sort of like the race to the end that the post-Hydra arc provides.
You can take it or leave it behind, Left Behind.
And honestly, it's one of the biggest nothing burgers of the rest of season 3. Even Par Avion had that really, you know, fun ending. Left Behind is an episode that I've always been, like, resoundingly meh about. You know, I never liked the whole main storyline. They literally took like a trope you find in a sitcom and applied it to two characters that would not get along. It's a Kate flashback that does reintroduce Cassidy. We do get, you know, like you said, there might be some Hurley and Sawyer stuff that is worth picking into, but I think especially coming from the man from Tallahassee to this, to that, is going to be a bit of a step down.
Yeah, but the good news is that I know we often say, like, it's the Brig, the man behind the curtain, greatest hits, and Through the Looking Glass. That's, like, just, like, the super dynamite 4 in a row.
Oh, don't say dynamite after we talked about Arse so much.
I know. But I even think, like, starting with One of Us and then Catch-22, which is a slam dunk episode for me, and DOC, I think
after this, besides DOC, I think we're pretty much in the clear.
Yeah, but I think like DOC has some remarkable Yeonjun Kim stuff and the return of King Daddy Kwan. So like there's a lot to be excited about there for us personally. So I do think like after Left Behind, we are effectively cooking with gas. And I don't mind like after like the few weeks that we've had, both in reality, but also in the Lost canon that we've been discussing. I don't mind having one where maybe we could just like sit back and like do like a tight 90 minutes would be great.
Like, you are jinxing the hell out of us. Are you handcuffing us to that time? Are you chaining us to that time limit?
I would love to do a tight 90, Mike, would be great.
Well, listen, I will outright say that's probably impossible, but let's see if we can shoot for it.
I will also say that I'm going to be I'm going away for a little while next week, so I'll be recording this from the road with internet quality that I don't know, not literally while I'm on the road, but with internet quality that I cannot currently attest to. So if there's like problems with the recording and scheduling with anything, we appreciate in advance anyone being flexible with the fact that maybe Left Behind could come could leave behind its traditional Friday spot. Of course, if you are one of those people who waits until 4 a.m. Eastern time for Down the Hatch to drop on a Friday, we appreciate your patience with Expose because we missed the mark on that. For reasons that I hope are self-evident.
Also, there's been a lot of like timing stuff as well. Josh, you and I have done a number of other podcasts this week that had to be recorded in the other days. So unfortunately, we can't wait to talk about XMZ. And honestly, the time we're talking about this, it was a perfect way to end the week, in my opinion. Yeah,
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's a matter of there's a lot going on in the middle of a lot going on.
Exactly.
And so to get an episode that's a total lark like XMZ, I was thrilled to do it. I hope that people enjoyed getting to relive this one. It's just such a blast. So Left Behind coming next week, coming out next week, hopefully in the normal spot. But if it's a little bit dicey, just bear with us. You could send your feedback to us for that podcast down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. You can talk to us in the Post Show Recaps patron Discord if you
sign up for
the Patreon at that Discord level. Yes, please. Do it's a great time,
which is the sequel to I Do, I believe.
Please do, yeah. That's going to be in Lost 2. Mike, anything else?
So Jessica, Lisa, and I are covering Star Trek Discovery here on Post Show Recaps. This past week's episode might, in my opinion, be one of my favorite episodes of the series. If you're talking about a show like Lost, where you weigh character versus plot, this was a very character-based episode, which is rare for Star Trek Disco, and I cannot wait to dig into it with Jessica Lee. So that is going on. Over on Rob Has a Podcast Proper, I finished up my Big Brother coverage on the B&B. Rob, Jess, and I are fervently digging into The Amazing Race, which has been so much fun so far. And Josh, not a long, long time ago, you and I and Rob Cesarino got together to simulate a season of Survivor featuring Star Wars characters that did indeed feature a character played by the one and only MVP himself, Billy Dee Williams.
That's correct. Lando Calrissian. And it's a great ride. I don't want to spoil anything about it, but we have a lot to say about Billy Dee Williams and Lando specifically on that one. And it was a really, really, really fun time. So check that out over at RHAP, and if you're thirsty for more Star Wars coverage, there's the weekly Mandalorian stuff that Kevin LaTanya and myself are doing, dropping on Mondays. Kevin and I are also talking Spider-Man on Everything is Super right now. That is our next focus following our Marvel Cinematic Universe rewatch. Fear the Walking Dead World Beyond with myself, Jessica Lee, and the great Chappelle. That's a blast, a really, really, really fun podcast. And the Aang and Their podcast, the Avatar The Last Airbender rewatch, Zach and Jake are continuing their march through season one. And that's just the forward-facing stuff. That's not even accounting for all the
podcasts.
We're
not talking about that sweet booty.
You know, the sweet booty known as Austin Powers that we just talked about.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that on Push. And literally, it was just an hour and a half of me, Emily, and Josh just, like, quoting the movie. And it was an absolute delight. I also dug up a deep of my own buried diamonds, if you will, as to my own links with Austin Powers and how it won me Mr. Muhlenberg, which was referenced on this podcast back in the day. So be sure to check that out. It was really fun.
Really fun. And then the community building podcast is happening over on the Patreon feed, the Watching with Wiggler podcast. So plenty happening on Post Show. Too much, some might say. To me, not quite enough. we're constantly grinding towards the point of too much, though. So next week, Left Behind. Mike, I believe you had a music cue, so why don't you take it away?